April 13th. It is 3:30 in the afternoon. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please silence all your phones, and we all agree as we sit here to treat each other respectfully, with dignity, and professionalism. So I welcome all of you, those who are present and online. I would like to introduce the dais to you this afternoon. To my left, the far end, is Mr. Carl Persis. He is school board member from District 4. Next to him is Mr. Carl Persis. He is school board member from...
Reuben
Cologne. Goodness gracious. Okay, double trouble here. Mr. Reuben Cologne, he's the school board member from District 5. Next to him is Mr. Ted Doran, our school board attorney. To my far right is Erin Lieben. She's our school agency clerk extraordinaire. Next to her left is our illustrious brand new school board member, but we're working at her in very good, Miss Anita Burnett. She represents District 2. And then next to her left is my vice chair this year, Miss Jamie Haynes. She represents District 1. To her left is our comeback kid, Dr. Scott Fritz, our superintendent. And I'm Linda Cuthbert. I represent District 3, and I'm your chairman for this year. So welcome. Items for approval on the agenda is 1.03, 5.02, 17.01, and 17.02. Public participation times. For items on the consent agenda, also we will have a 5 o'clock certain public participation for general interest pertaining to public education in Volusia County. Total of 15 minutes. But we do extend, if you come and you spend time in efforts to come to speak to us, we will hear you. When you come to the dais, you have 3 minutes to speak. You state your name and the area from which you come. Time will be provided for public comment on any action item before us when a board vote is called on that item, and we have two of those this evening. Time will also be provided at the end of the meeting for public comment for general interest and comments for public education in our school district. So thank you. 1.02, we now will hear from our school board members about our district vision statement, and would anyone like to begin? Mr. Cologne?
Sure.
Thank you.
So our vision statement is to create lifelong learners prepared for an ever-changing global society, and this morning I had the pleasure of visiting Pine Ridge and the HVAC Academy that is quickly starting to take shape. They were getting some of the electrical stuff mapped out and ready to go. And so it's super exciting because I know that that's going to reach a subset of students who this is going to change their lives forever. And as you all will be pleasantly surprised, the interest in the program is very, very high. Just from Pine Ridge alone, I believe there were at somewhere between 150 and 160 students, and they will also be extending it out to looking for folks from the middle schools, the neighboring middle schools as well, in order to ensure that we've got students in there who truly it will make a difference in their life. So I'd like to thank Dr. Fritz, Bree, I know you're back there, so there she is, and Dr. Nerig and all of those who have taken this vision and desire to bring back vocational education to Volusia County, taking it seriously and putting the action where it belongs for our students, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cologne. Mr. Persis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Today, I was over at Palm Terrace Elementary School, and I was there because they had delayed their FSA TET testing one week, which they were allowed to do, and it was just the third graders, and we with Mr. Harris, the principal. We went to all of the classes and, you know, just gave him a little pep talk and everything. And I will just say that if those students were half as motivated and had half the energy of their principal, they will all just absolutely make perfect scores on that test. So they were really fired up today at Palm Terrace, and it was just great. Great being there. It's always great being over there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Persis. Mrs. Burnett.
Good afternoon. As we've mentioned, we're in this for the students and to make lifelong changes in our changing global society. And I was at Campbell today, and they're doing those things there. It was great. I got to walk around for a couple hours and be introduced to some of the students. They are very engaged over there. And while I was there, there was a representative from the police station there trying to engage some of the students and making sure that they know that the police are on their side and that we're there to help them and to make a partnership of that. And so it was nice to see something of that nature happening in a positive direction. So it was very nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burnett. Ms. Haynes.
Thank you, Mrs. Cuthbert. There's a lot of events starting to happen at this time of the year, and there's a lot of wonderful things going on out in our schools, and we're starting to honor a lot of our teachers and staff and everything. And, we did a Teacher of the Year earlier this year, but we just did the first year Teachers of the Year just last week, and Mr. Persis stepped in, and I heard gave a great speech about what it's like being a first year teacher, which some of us have lived through. But this year, first year teachers, not only were they a first year, which is always kind of exciting, but at the same time a little scary, when you're out there for the first. Wonderful gentlemen, first-year teachers, the elementary one being from Citrus Grove, which is Brian Levine, and the secondary one being from Henson, which is Shane Story, that were honored last week. And at the same time, we also had some of our volunteers that they've started honoring last week and this week. And these not only are the first-year teachers making such a difference. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to say to a few of the first-year teachers that have come in, that their job is they're replacing those of us as we finish our career. And there's a few out there that I actually taught, just like I'm sure the two of you did along the way. But our volunteers are also the backbone. And I'm happy that we are opening back up and we're letting our volunteers in, because some of these volunteers, this is their life also. Their joy and their pleasure comes from being able to be on campus and make a positive difference in the lives of kids. And so I'm happy to see that we're not only bringing them back, but we're starting to honor them for their time. Because I will tell you, as a former classroom teacher, every volunteer that walked through the door, regardless of what they did, if they just read with a child, if they cut out, something for an activity or whatever, that lifted a burden off of my plate that allowed me to focus on more of the things that I needed to do. So I'm just so appreciative of all of our first-year teachers, and we want every one of you to stay, and I'm appreciative of all of our volunteers. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hayes. I want to give a shout-out to the Port Orange South Daytona Chamber of Commerce, who all year have been working on, in their education committee, of which I'm a member, to make career videos for our students in the Port Orange, South Daytona area. They've engaged students from Spruce Creek High School and Atlantic High School, the two high schools in their district, to help film careers. They've been going, businesses have volunteered in the area to explain how they operate their businesses. A pizzeria, for example, went in the back before people were in there, so to make sure that they understand what it is to own a business, how to run it, and it's just not from what you see on the outside when you visit a business, but the background of it, just to get a little more CTE experience at the elementary level. Plus, we're also working on field trips as well, virtual field trips. So thank you to the Port Orange South Daytona Chamber, who is working with two kinds of communities to help provide more opportunities for our students. And also an update from me. I'm not cancer-free. It's a watch and wait for reoccurrence. I've had two surgeries in the last month, so I apologize for not being here the last. I've missed two meetings since January. So, but thank you for being patient as I fight on. So thank you. Excuse me. 1.03, approval of the minutes. We have quite a few on our list here. Board members, are there any corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, is there a motion?
Move approval.
Move approval. Is there a second?
A second.
Okay, any other further discussion? All those in favor of approving all these minutes, and these minutes are from our workshop. Let's see, our workshop session of February 23, meeting from February 23rd, workshops, regular session on March 9th, workshop session March 9th, as well as regular session the 30th, as well as the workshop session on March 30th. Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against, please say nay. Motion is carried unanimously. 2.01. Dr. Pritz, are there any changes?
Yes, ma'am. We do have one change for today. We're adding 14.02, where I will give an update on the graduation that we're also very much interested in. And also, I have Melanie Kestery that's going to be here today to kind of walk us through some of the changes in practices that will occur with the executive order that was released on Friday.
Okay. All right, then, let's do 2.02, approval of the amended agenda. Is there a motion?
Motion to approve the agenda as amended.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Colon. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Burnett. Is there any more discussion of the agenda? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against, please say nay. The motion is carried unanimously. Thank you. 3.01, recognitions. Dr. Fritz.
Boy, we have three outstanding recognitions today. I'm very, very excited. The first one is about declaring April as our National Bilingual Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. We celebrate our ESOL students and our heritage learners whose heritage languages are supported in our K-12 world. Each year, we provide proficiency assessments opportunities for our heritage and our native speakers so they can proudly be recognized as bilingual and multilingual students with the seal of biliteracy as they go forward and show that proficiency. So it's with great pleasure that I recognize this month of April 2021 as National Bilingual Multilingual Learner Advocacy Month. The next recognition we have, declaring the week of April 19th through the 23rd, is After Schools Professionals Week. Our future depends on providing high-quality child care services to all of our students and families. Our EDEP program, which stands for Extended Day Enrichment, and our Before the Bell program serve approximately 3,200 students in over 40 elementary schools in 10 of our middle schools in Volusia County. These programs provide a safe environment for our students to develop friendships, explore new hobbies and interests. Thank you for all those caring adults who take care of our children before and after school. We'd also like to recognize April 21, 2021, as National Administrative Professional Day. I am here to tell you that is an extremely important day. This organization would come to a stop if it was not for the administrative assistance that all of us receive on a daily basis from our team.
We have one right here on the dais.
We absolutely do. We absolutely do, Ms. Aaron. So we will be celebrating that day, and we will celebrate those people that help us, and they help us make us look good. So we're very, very happy. That's it, ma'am.
Thank you, Dr. Fritz. You're absolutely right. We're all three absolutely fantastic ones. 4.01, public participation for items on the consent agenda. Do we have any, Ms. Schultz? Thank you very much. 5.01, Dr. Fritz, do we have any items to be removed from the consent agenda?
No, ma'am.
All right, 5.02, is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Move approval, Madam Chair.
Move approval by Mr. Persis. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, Ms. Anita Burnett seconded the motion. Is there any discussion from the board? I would like to have Mr. Grube, if he's available, to come up and speak to two on the consent agenda. And that is 10.015 and 10.16. And it has to do the half-cent sales tax replacement of two high school tracks at Mainland High School and at New Smyrna Beach High School. If he could elaborate. And they're costing half-cent sales tax $550,000 apiece. Thank you, Mr. Grove, for coming forward.
Am I on?
I think so.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, board members, Dr. Fritz. I've been asked to bring some additional information to you regarding the
I thought I was silent there for a second. What I'm passing around is what most of you might think of when you're picturing in your mind what's happening to a remodel of a track, and that's just a portion of what is typically goes on in one of these projects. That's the top coat, and that's a half-inch polyurethane surface that we use on our tracks. And what happens is that gets the old track gets stripped off, much like you'll see on the highway when they're taking that top coat off to resurface. Underneath this, you're going to find several inches of asphalt on top of a crushed limestone base. So this is a piece of every project, but it's certainly not the entire extent of each project. So they do vary widely in the scope. And if you'd like me to, I can explain a little bit more about what's happening with these projects we're talking about today. Both projects are budgeted in the amount of $550,000, and that's based upon previous experience on similar projects, and also canvassed some of our surrounding districts to see what they're doing to get some consistency on those numbers. So Mainland High School quite a bit going on there. In addition to resurfacing the track, we're also relocating the pole vault and the runway and relocating the broad jump and triple jump runways, which are currently on the sideline of the field. We're moving those to behind the end zones. The reason for that is that right now the field is not wide enough to play soccer. They need 180 feet, so by moving those to the sides, we can now do both football and soccer on that field. We'll, of course, be resurfacing those in addition to moving them. We're also moving the straight part of the track where you often see the sprints. We're moving those from the west side to the east side in preparation of new bleachers to go in a subsequent project. We have to raise drainage units. We have to resod the field. There's a lot of other things going on there that really encompass the entire breadth and scope of this project. Similar to what we did in previous projects, just so you know, these are the 7th and 8th track remodeling projects we will have done in the past 3 years. We did 3 of them in 2019, DeLand, Pine Ridge, and Seabreeze. 2020, we did Atlantic, Deltona, and Spruce Creek High School, and they varied widely in scope and cost. One of the most expensive ones was Atlantic, where quite a bit of work had to be done there. We had to add an additional lane to the track, moving it from 7 to 8 in order to comply with current standards.
So that was the Florida Athletic Florida High School Athletic Association said that?
Yes, ma'am, and the National Federation of State High Schools and the American Sports Builders Association. They all have a say in the standards that are set, the way they're laid out and the way they're striped and everything. As we prepare for these projects, again, these are Phase 3 documents. They're the signed and sealed engineering set of drawings that we're going to take out to bid very soon in anticipation of doing this work over the summer. I was in contact with some of my peers at surrounding districts. I talked with Osceola Schools, and the most recent project they did with a similar scope but a little bit different was right about $400,000 for that project. Orange County Public Schools has 18 schools that they've set up on a rotating basis to do in the next 4 years, and their program is a little bit more aggressive than ours, a little bit more costly than ours. They're actually spending, in excess of $800,000 per campus in order to do their track, improve their drainage, and to do their field events, like I mentioned before. So I'm confident that we're scoped properly here. We've got a great engineer on board. We're expecting to get some really competitive bids on these projects. And if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Board members? I just have one. This will help any school that we have now to host like a regional or district-wide track event, correct?
As far as the track and field itself goes, I'm not sure what other amenities that they may be looking for in terms of grandstands and spectator capacity and things of that nature. But certainly in terms of the quality of the field itself, yes, this brings them up to the state-of-the-art standards.
Because that's important to the school's athletic program in raising funds for their programs. Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. Group on any other part of the consent agenda?
I actually had a question about 10.05. So, Mr. Group, on 10.05, we originally allocated $157,309.36 for the project at Sweetwater Elementary to replace the fire alarm. And it's now coming back that we're having to put approximately an additional $278,025.64 towards that. I mean, I get it when we see something, go up because of the materials and supplies have gone up, but we more than doubled the price of what this is going to cost. So are we staying with the same person that, had we already selected someone and they came in originally with $157,000 and now we're up to $435,000? Those are just my questions, because that's a lot of money to move from this is what it was going to cost us to this is what it's costing us.
To be honest with you, I don't have that back up in front of me to really properly answer the question. I do know that there were some scope changes there. It increased the amount of work that we're doing on the campus, and that the previous budget was set several years ago. And over time, there are some changes, certainly some changes. I'd be happy to get back to you on that, though, and with more in greater detail as to exactly what's going on there.
Okay. Then, Mrs. Haynes, do you want to remove this or go ahead and...
Is it time-sensitive, like, for approval for this evening as far as for you starting the project? Do you have, like, a start date, or could this go on to the next agenda so that we understand why it went from that price to 400 and some thousand?
Of course, everything on here is time sensitive when we're coming to summer projects, but I would probably be safe to say that we could wait one more cycle to get you the proper answers on this one.
Because like I said, when we see a $30,000 increase or something like that, and I want to thank you, because you've got how many items previously where you've saved money. Like, you've come back in and said we've gained this much back because we purchased the materials ourselves, and I appreciate that. It's just this one stood out because that's just a very, it's a very significant increase. And so I just wondered how, fire alarm project went from that to this.
Yes, ma'am, I understand.
Thank you. And I know that Sweetwater is about 26 years old now, and I'm curious, when you come back with that information, could you let us know if this is the first replacement of the alarm system?
I can find that out for you.
Yeah, and also let us know. We usually see alarm systems replaced in our schools, which I'm sure very, very necessary. But how often do they have to be replaced? Hopefully not near as often as HVAC, especially on the beach side. Okay. Thank you. So we're going to remove, we're going to amend the consent agenda, remove 10.05, and put that on the consent agenda for our meeting on the 27th of April. So I would like to, we have a motion to approve the consent agenda. So let's go back. Let's see, what best way to do this? To go back and amend it?
Mrs. Cuthbert.
Yes.
I don't have so much of a question, but I have something I'd like to say for a moment about 11.01.
Oh, yes, ma'am. 11.01. Yes, ma'am.
I know a lot of what has happened here with 11.01, but in transparency, I just need to make sure that what's happened here with 11.01 is not going to happen again. You know, that because we have policies in place so that we're not approving something after the fact, especially for this amount. And I think if we went by this evening and no one said anything, then we would not be doing our due diligence or being transparent with, you know, that this event happened without, you know, any approval from any of us sitting up here. I want to say thank you to Mr. Penley and Dr. Fritz and everyone that worked on figuring this out so that there is a savings here. But I think moving forward, we just need to ensure that we won't ever be sitting here in the boardroom again, being faced with approving something that to this magnitude after the fact.
Yes, thank you. As yes, Mr. Cologne.
And so I was going to bring this up later, but I think we need to, or I would like for us to revisit the policy for purchasing and bring back, because we, you know, one of the things that we are is policymakers, and, you know, making sure that we have the safeguards in place that would keep, you know, an invoice. And again, as she said, thank you to all of the folks that were involved with renegotiating these fees that were charged. However, we need to ensure that our policy, that there are the checks and balances in place in order so that we don't end up here again. And, you know, that's one of the, you know, it's what we're tasked with, looking at policies. So clearly there's room for improvement, and I think re-looking at that policies and procedures and checks and balances that are in place will be a good thing for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Persis.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think just to clear the air.
Yes, please do.
The audience probably doesn't have any idea.
Yes, if you weren't, I was going to do that.
perhaps Dr. Fritz, you would like to comment on what this is all about, or so people would really understand.
Sure. There was a tornado that struck one of our schools. It was George Marks, and there was some emergency cleanup that had to happen. And the district does have the authority when the catastrophe hits to go ahead and make things safe and to clean them up and to do that. The concern was the scope was broader than originally planned. And so some of that went back, and Mr. Penley led that for us and reviewed some of what the scope of work really entailed. And so coming back, this board agenda item represents a adjusted figure that we are agreed to pay.
Well, I guess my point is, I mean, we had to clean it up, and we had to do what we had to do to make it safe. And if that's what it costs, I mean, that's what it costs. That's what I'm getting at. I don't want the public to think that we overspent or we did something that we shouldn't have done. We we had to pay if the project, the work scope of it, was greater than what we thought. But at the end of the day, we had to do it. I mean, we had to do it. So I don't think we overpaid. It just was, it was a bigger project than what we thought.
Well, the scope of the work was broader than it needed to be, and that's what the argument was for the emergency.
Got it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. The protocol has been in the past to contact. If there's an emergency, for example, there was one at Ormond Beach Elementary, needed a brand new HVAC, but they notified, you all notified the superintendent at the time, notified the board members. We said verbally, yeah, get it done, because the HVAC company had one in stock, and they were willing to put it in right away at great expense. There was no one who contacted the superintendent at the time, and that was Dr. Balgaman. She was not contacted of the emergency or to even okay the work to go forward. When the billing came in, I was the one that questioned the billing because there were no details. There was no hourly rate, the number of people, the equipment used. And so I objected to it, and I did find a few things irregular, which the district took under control. Then there was another bill that came before us. I had it removed from the consent agenda because I still thought it was irregular and not, there was no details, once again. And so thank you to our internal audit that we had. They went back and paired, along with Mr. Penley's guidance and the internal audit company, compared the actual documents, the actual billings, to make sure that what we were paying for was documented evidence of work performed, of equipment performed, of rented or used over a certain period of days. And so we are saving over $200,000 in billing, I think in 11.01. And so the district absolutely did its due diligence. I saw a report on the cleanup that the district presented to me. Thank you, Dr. Balgaman. And so I must give a great deal of credit to the purchasing department who questioned a lot of this. And so we always really have to do our job. And the consent agenda is not just a blind vote. We do read them. We want as much background information as possible. If there's something, and we do, we have a wonderful department. Dr. Fritz has a wonderful staff who answers our questions. You can ask anyone, especially Ms. Mueller back there. Thanks, Ms. Mueller, who answers all kinds of wonderful questions, very patient, very kind. And it's we couldn't do it without them. And we have this due diligence on our part to make sure that we spend the taxpayer money as appropriately as possible and not waste it. So, but thank you. We appreciate your department for getting all this straightened out. So, anything else, Mr. F? Anything else from Mr. Group? Yes, Mr. Person.
I had a telephone conversation this afternoon with Dr. Fritz, and I commented about how happy I was with the architectural firm that was selected to design, I guess, the new Charity Small. And I noticed that they had built this amazing school in Kissimmee, and that's why I called Dr. Fritz. If it was as good as it looked, you know, and he, go ahead, if you want to comment, it seemed like a great idea.
It's actually the first Neo City Academy in Osceola County is the first of its kind where it's a zero energy school. It actually produces energy, and rather than costing the district energy funds, it's actually securing funds the way it's designed. It's actually Neo City Academy is a STEM school that focuses on three pathways for engineering. And these students actually use the building as an instructional tool, which is very neat. Ms. Haynes got to see it. That's the first time I actually get to meet Ms. Haynes. And she got to see it, but it was actually a very economical school to build. It was about $12 million, and it houses about 500 students. So, yeah. So we're very pleased that this architectural firm is part of Turie T, the rebuilding. We will work with them as we go forward. And the idea behind a building should be more than just a building. When I mentioned to you earlier that with Neo City Academy, for example, it is an instructional tool for our students. As we go through and we start to design Turie T, that will be some directions that we give the architect as we move forward. How do we utilize this building to produce learning for our students as well as to save us energy? Little Diversified Architecture is the firm. And if I could add, Dr. Fritz,
last name.
Yes.
I have Mark Clinch on the hook for a board workshop to explain in more detail the high-performance school and the zero-net program. So I'm going to get that scheduled as soon as I can.
Excellent. Perfect.
Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Persis. Mr. Klum?
Ready for a motion?
Yes. Well, who made the first motion before? Can you change your motion?
So I will amend my motion to approve the consent agenda with the exception of
10.05. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Any more discussion? All those in favor of approving the amended consent agenda, please say aye.
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 All those disapprove, please say nay. It has moved, been moved and approved unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Groom.
Thank you.
Okay, 1401, superintendent's announcements and comments.
Okay, we have a lot going on this time of the year. Friday, April 16th, we have our all-county elementary music showcase at 7 p.m. at Port Orange Amphitheater. The week of April 19th through the 23rd is also Public School Volunteer Week. As we mentioned earlier, we just celebrated our Volunteer of the Year. Yeah, very excited about that.
And they're back on as of yesterday, too.
I'm sorry?
They're back, too, as of yesterday.
Oh, okay. Yes, they are. Futures Tomorrow Leaders graduation will be Tuesday, April 20th at Jackie Robinson Ballfield at 5 p.m. The All-County Band Showcase is Thursday, April 22nd. At 7 p.m. at Port Orange Amphitheater. The next school board workshop will be Tuesday, April 27th at 1 p.m. in this boardroom. The next regular board meeting will also be April 27th at 5:30. And that's 14.1. Would you like me to go to 14.2?
Certainly.
Okay.
District update.
I do have a graduation update. At first, I'd like to share the press release went out where we were able to, with Mr. Doran's help, secure some better terms for us as a school district when it comes to allowing our students and families to participate in graduation. So, Mr. Doran, I'd like to publicly thank you for helping us with that. Also, pleased to announce that we've gone from 2 to 4 to 6 tickets for each of our family members. That's a big deal. But I'll share with you how we're looking at this. We still want to do this very safely. We want to make sure that our families get to enjoy this event, but we want to make sure that we're doing it the right way. So we will stay attuned to CDC recommendations, the State of Florida, World Health Organization, and what we will do is we will re-examine this every couple weeks to see where we're at as we approach those graduations, which are still a month and a half away. If there's opportunity to do it safely, then we will continue to see where increases can occur. Right now, we are hovering in the 50% of the capacity of the OC. And that is what the recommendations are at, but that is with 6 tickets. So should the regulations change at the state level with the World Health Organization and with CDC as they start to progress, then we can come back and readdress that. But I'll keep updating you every time we come to the board table. Okay. Okay, the next thing we'd like to do is I'm going to ask Melanie Kestery to come forward as she does. Board members, on Friday around 10:30, I will tell you I was able to visit many, many schools last week, but as we were visiting, my phone started to blow up at 10:30 for an 11 o'clock in the morning webinar from the State of Florida Department of Education. And so pulling over to a parking lot, Dr. Balgamon was in one parking lot, I was in the other, and we logged in and listened. And very, very good news. We're appreciative that grace and compassion were exercised by the Department of Education when it came to school districts, recognizing this is a year unlike any other, and what things we were able to do for our students, for our employees, and for their families. And today what we'd like to do is walk through a PowerPoint with you that's very simple to understand. There are some district decisions that we had to make that we're entitled to make, these liberties that the state of Florida has given districts to make, and we will share what those liberties are. I will tell you that tomorrow we will release a frequently asked questions on our website as well as to our principals so that when parents have questions about this executive order, they can certainly get to it very quickly on our website to see it, and we will share it with our principals who will follow steps. So this is all Volusia County schools rowing together. Ms. Kestery?
Absolutely. Just a second. Board members, you have a copy of the PowerPoint in your books, your black scrapbooks that Mr. Doran gave us. So you've got copies. Thank you. I'm sorry, Ms. Kestery.
That's okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, board members, and Dr. Fritz. On April 9th, as Dr. Fritz just mentioned, Florida Commissioner of Education Richard Cochran released Emergency Order 2021-EO2, which provides school districts with maximum flexibility on topics such as graduation requirements for current seniors, student promotion, retention decisions, and Bright Futures Awards. During tonight's presentation, I will go into detail on each topic, as well as the implications of the emergency orders for Volusia County students and families. The executive order supports the values of assessment so that we have access to formative and student data to inform district priorities, student placement, as well as student performance. We are continuing to move forward in testing as many students as we can, but also recognize that parents and students are not comfortable coming back to school. Therefore, I think one of the themes that resonates throughout the executive order is maximizing flexibility for districts to continue to extend grace and compassion for students and teachers. As a result of the executive order, school districts are authorized to waive the state assessment requirements for graduation, which includes the 10th grade FSA ELA, as well as the Algebra 1 end of course exam. Other graduation requirements, such as the 18 or 24 credits, as well as a minimum of 2.0 GPA, are still in place. It is important to note that the assessment waiver only pertains to those students expected to graduate in the spring of 2021. Students should contact their school counselor for any eligibility questions they have. The district is also authorized to waive the required assessments for scholar designations. Again, this is applicable for students who are expected to graduate in the spring of 2021. Students that have met all other criteria for scholar and merit designation, including earning a C or higher in the respective designation courses, but have been unable to take the state assessments, are still able to qualify for the designation. For example, many of our seniors would have taken U.S. History last year. Passing the U.S. History EOC was previously a scholar designation requirement. However, last year's juniors did not have the opportunity to take the EOC due to testing cancellation. This is just one of the many examples of the required assessments that have been waived for scholar designation. While we have set great goals and high expectations for students this year, we also recognize the many, many challenges that students and teachers have faced. Therefore, schools will not be given a school grade this year. However, schools do have the option to opt in to receiving a school grade if they feel that it positively benefits the school. Once scores are released in late July, the districts will have 30 days to review the data and apply to opt into a school grade if they choose. It is important to note that schools must have tested a minimum of 90% of their eligible students to apply to opt in, with 95% tested being approved. For schools that apply to opt in, the state will review the data to ensure that the assessment data fairly and accurately represents all students enrolled at that school. For example, if a school tested 90% of their student population, the state would review the assessment data to ensure that the 92% tested is a fair representation of their school's demographics. If the 8% tested that did not test represented a large percent of a subgroup, for example, students with disabilities, that would be a cause for the application to be rejected. Schools that do not opt in will retain their pre-COVID school grade status or school improvement rating. Learning gains for students will be determined by comparing the 2018-2019 individual student results to this year's individual results. Traditionally, learning gains are determined from one year to the next. However, with the cancellation of state testing last year, learning gains are spread over a two-year time. It is important to note that only students that have a prior FSA score are eligible to demonstrate a learning gain. For example, a seventh grade student's ELA FSA score will be compared to their fifth grade FSA score to determine growth. In elementary school, typically fourth and fifth grade students can demonstrate learning gains. However, since there was no state testing last year, the fifth grade students are primarily the only ones who will have a prior score to determine the learning gain. This places a heavy emphasis on our fifth grade class this year. This also aligns with the information that the state provided earlier in the year, and we have been working closely with leadership to ensure that they are prepared for this unprecedented accountability system. The executive order also authorizes districts to waive the end of course exam calculation into the final grade. Typically, for those courses that require an end of course exam, the EOC score counts as 30% of the overall grade. This year, the final grades for EOC courses will be solely based on the four-quarter grade calculation. It is important to note that this waiver only applies to courses taken and successfully completed during the 21 school year. The EOC courses are Civics in 7th grade, Algebra 1, Geometry, Biology 1, and U.S. History. While the end-of-course exams that I listed above do not count for 30% of a student's overall grade this year, it is extremely important to note that those end-of-course exams will continue to be counted as a graduation requirement, as well as being used for scholar designations for students that are not graduating this year. For example, if a 10th grader is taking Algebra 1, the end-of-course exam will not count as their 30% of their overall grade due to the executive order. However, that student is still required to pass the Algebra 1 EOC as a graduation requirement because, remember, the assessment waiver is only for students who are expected to graduate during the spring of 21. I know I've said that a few times already. We must ensure that this executive order does not diminish the value and importance of our state assessments. As you know, for third graders, the reading FSA carries very high stakes, as it is typically a retention year. For third graders who score a level one or do not take the FSA, the executive order authorizes the district to provide reliable evidence of a student's performance or good cause exemption from retention. Good cause includes a qualifying score on the iReady Diagnostic 3, which students will take at the end of May, curriculum portfolio points, which are accumulated throughout the year, or other qualifying exemptions that are specific to English language learners and students with disabilities. Those will all remain in place. Any third grade student that is demonstrating a severe reading deficiency and is trending towards the level one range will be invited to the third grade reading camp. As we have heard at previous school board meetings, Volusia County Schools is offering a very robust summer program. For third grade students specifically, opportunities over the summer include face-to-face or virtual tutoring in June, as well as face-to-face third grade reading camp in July. 10 sites will have a face-to-face tutoring, and the virtual tutoring will be available at other sites. This year, third grade students with a reading deficiency have potential for summer opportunities in both June and July. For students that are expected to graduate in the spring of 21, there has also been flexibility in regards to Bright Futures. Typically, students have until June 30th to earn a qualifying ACT or SAT score. The executive order has extended the deadline to earn a qualifying score until December 1st, 2021. Additionally, seniors expected to graduate in the spring of 21 are also provided flexibility for volunteer hours for Bright Futures applications. It is important to note that the flexibility is granted towards seniors that were already working towards meeting those requirements prior to the start of the pandemic, but were unable to fulfill their volunteer hours due to health concerns or limited volunteer opportunities. Again, students should contact their guidance, their school counselors, for any questions they have. The school district is also authorized to suspend the value-added model system, known as VAM, as part of the calculation of the summative evaluations for instructional and administrative staff. Over the weekend, Dr. Fritz sent an email to all staff notifying them that VAM scores will not be used in the calculation of summative evaluations for instructional and administrative staff this year. However, it is important to note that that the Department of Education will still be calculating VAM scores for teachers in those eligible courses. Teachers in eligible courses will still be awarded a single-year, two-year, and three-year aggregate score calculated by the department. VAM will likely continue to be used in transformation schools for hiring purposes, as well as retention of quality teachers. Teachers have the option to verify the roster that their VAM score is based on through a process called roster verification. We are currently in the roster verification process as we speak. And lastly, this school, for some districts, the 21 summer VP program will consist of a minimum of 200 hours of instruction rather than 300 hours. That is typically required in a VPK program. That is because of the extended school year. However, in Volusia County, I've confirmed with Wendy Reeves that we will be offering our full 300 hours. That works well within our schedule this year. At this time, I will open it up to any additional questions you have.
Thank you, Melanie.
Thank you, Ms. Kestry, very much. Mr. Colon.
All right. So I think the key word that sticks out to me a lot is case by case. And I know a lot of parents have reached out and asked, is this the same as last year? What does Dr. Fritz or either one, what do we envision this case by case? In other words, each student will be looked at individually. This is not a blanket. Everybody is, you know, moved on. What does that look like?
It actually isn't really a case by case. More so, when we look at case by case, it's very specific. For example, we're putting conditions in that will apply to all students. But when we're looking at things like third grade retention, we have the flexibility with using the portfolios and student-based evidence to move a student on. So that's the case by case that we're talking about. If a student does not show evidence to be able to move on, then we can mandate that they come to a virtual or a brick and mortar summer program so they can get some enrichment and extra support before we make a recommendation whether or not that child goes on to fourth grade or repeats third grade. That would be an example of case by case. The earning the credit in algebra really is not a case by case. So, for example, if you pass the course, you're moving on. You're getting credit for that course. So some of the things in the way we went through and made these decisions will apply to all of our students, but the third grade is probably the best example I can think of off the top of my head where we will look at students case by case.
So you mentioned something that's important for folks to understand, and it's that if a child has straight, I'm just going to go extreme, they have straight Fs, they're in third grade, and their iReady scores are not where they should be along with all the other assessments. I'm sure there's acronyms I'm missing out on. We may require that student to, as a condition, to be considered for the following grade. They may be required to participate in the summer program.
Correct.
At which point then we would determine, and this is what I heard, we would then determine if that student then meets the criteria and whatever the criteria may be to move on to the following grade. What does the process of appeal look like? So let's say we tell a family who's been on live and, you know, and they we say your child doesn't have the supporting portfolio scores to move on, and they say, well, I don't want my kid to do anything in the summer. It's vacation time.
The process of appeal is the same as it always has been, where they would refer that back to the principal. The principal will consult with the district staff, and then we'll make a determination on that. But, you know, the evidence itself, at this point in the game, you know, we're going to want to see some evidence. I'll be very transparent here. You're going to want to see some evidence of mastery of those standards, or at least the attempt. That's why the virtual option is there. If a parent wants to go on a vacation with their child, they can. They just need to be able to have that virtual approach. But the appeal process, to your question, will be the same. It'll go from the, you know, from the principal through Ms. Clayton, and Ms. Clayton and her team will help guide that direction.
Great. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. Ms. Burnett.
Yeah, I have a question. Thank you. The algebra that's still required to graduate, when will the students be offered that test since it's still a requirement?
So we are continuing to test through the remainder of the year. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, there are several makeup opportunities throughout the year. So, for example, this year, a student that would have needed algebra would have had three opportunities, once in the fall, once in the winter, and then once again in the spring. So there are multiple opportunities throughout the year at each of the schools. And again, I believe there'll be an opportunity over the summer as well.
And so what if the student did not want to come into the brick and mortar and take advantage of any of these opportunities? Will there be an opportunity next year, and will they have some opportunity for some help to remember what they learned the year before?
Absolutely. You bring up a good point, which is seizing the opportunity while the information is fresh in the student's mind. So that would be the first recommendation, but I know that doesn't necessarily work for all students. As I mentioned, each student would have up to four opportunities throughout the year to take the assessment. Many schools will do a boot camp style right before the assessment, and sometimes, you know, if they're taking the assessment in the afternoon, they would do it that morning or a couple days leading up to. So they are preparing those students for, you know, really honing in on the skills they need for that, for the Algebra 1. But again, I think the key is if it is possible to take it while they're taking the course, because that's when it's most fresh in their mind.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ms. Kestry, I believe they can also earn a score on the geometry EOC, correct? It is a concordant for that Algebra EOC. That was one of the things that we learned about from last year, is that correct?
Yes, the geometry acts as a concordant for the algebra EOC. So there are other opportunities. In addition to that, this year PERT, it has been also a concordant for the algebra EOC. This will be the last year that PERT is a concordant for that score.
Okay. Any more, Ms. Burnett?
No, thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you. Ms. Haynes.
No, this is what I want to say. This is what we were kind of hoping for during the summer when we talked about, you know, the possibility because of what our students faced last spring and the fact that we didn't have any data, was that the state would, you know, stop and take a look at this. So I was actually very encouraged on Friday when this came out. You know, I understand the need for whoever we can go ahead and test, please, let's test, because we really just kind of need to know where our kids are at. You know, have they made up what they missed last spring and, you know, with a little bit later of a start date for us? You know, are there some areas that we need to still concentrate on that can happen if they choose a virtual or a face-to-face summer program? Or it gives that teacher next year a heads up of like where they're at and some of the standards that they may need to back up and go over. But I am very appreciative because, you know, at first it looked like we were going to be grading everyone as they said, taking seventh graders and looking at what's their learning gains from fifth to seventh grade. And that's, you know, that's just impossible. I mean, that was just going to be a huge, heavy burden on everyone. Because if you figure, you know, last year they were in sixth grade with no assessments, you just really didn't know where they are. And it's been a moving target all year. You know, parents have done a great job. Teachers have done a great job. Kids have done a great job. But there's been a lot of movement and in and out. So I'm very appreciative of the fact that, you know, they've given us these options and they gave us choices, you know, and choices are nice. I mean, when we kind of sent that letter up in the fall and kind of asked, you know, to consider this, I didn't think we would, I figured something was going to come, you know, and I actually, we got it a little earlier, I think, than what I thought we would get it, but I didn't think they were going to give us truly options where they would allow us or allow Dr. Fritz and his staff at the district level to make the choices. I figured they would just still come down and dictate it. And I like the flexibility, I'll be honest with you. I like the fact that you can actually look and if one of our, you know, focus schools has made the growth and they test that 90% of their students are higher, then we've got the option to boost up their grade to possibly get them out of being a focus school or not having somebody marching in and out of their classroom, you know, every day. Because those teachers, you know, go through a lot. Their classrooms are revolving doors of people walking in and out. And I also, even though I'm happy to see that we're still going to be able to maintain the 300 hours this summer for VPK, I'm appreciative that they gave an option there also. And, you know, and I may reach out to Wendy if you don't mind, Dr. Fritz, because
sure.
I'm hoping because they said 200, you know, that maybe if there is a conflict with a family that they won't get penalized if they do have to miss, you know,
right.
a few hours or whatever. But I just, you know, I expected something or I think I was hoping for something. But I think we got a lot more than what any of us could have asked for. And so I'm very pleased with what they've come out with and the fact, too, for what they're, you know, and I thank you for sending out the email about the VAM scores and all of that, because it's been a tough year, but everybody's worked really hard, and it's nice to see that they've taken that into consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Mr. Persis.
Yeah, just a quick comment. I think I agree with everything you said, of course, and I think it just goes to show the impact that collectively we can have on the state legislature and the governor and the commissioner of education when you have the Florida School Board Association, the Superintendents Association, the Teachers Union, the Florida PTA, name it, any group that was associated with children in any way, they were all saying the same thing. And when everybody is just about saying the same thing, give or take a few, you know, tweets here and there, the legislature, the governor, listen. And as to your point, other organizations were saying even more than what maybe we were saying. And so that's why I think we came out with a final product that is so flexible in nature with all the options. And I think it just, I know I was fearful too about, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Now to come out with this, so I don't often praise what they do up there to us in Tallahassee, but this time I am commending them. I think they listened, and I'm happy with the result.
Thank you. It just goes to show that speaking up is very important. We have to lift our voices up to our state legislators, and it's. Because there can be a result in our favor, especially with the recent parents objecting to the Bright Futures when the state legislator wanted to narrow the ability of students to take whatever course series that they wanted, that they were trying to do it just so it would be career ready. And that's I mean, I have a bachelor's in English literature. Of course, I taught English, but I had a degree in secondary ed as well. But still, if I had just had my bachelor's in English, what could I have used that for? I would never have been able to be a Bright Future Scholar. So you'd have to go to a master's program. It's very important that we continue to lobby for what is best for our students. And there's still a lot of work to be done because this is not the best year of legislation for education at all. There's still some, we still have to fight for Bright Futures because they want to tie it into whatever the money available is each legislative year. And so one year you might be eligible and the next year you might not be eligible. And this is not good for parents when they need to start budgeting for college education for their children. So that we need to continue to be very much aware of what's happening. So, Ms. Kestry, I have a grandson who was an eighth grader last year, was delighted that he didn't have to take the algebra EOC. So this year he's taking geometry. Does he still have to take the EOC, or is it skipped?
The information that we have right now indicates that graduation requirements for non-seniors will remain the same. I'm sure, you know, just as we did this year, I'm sure the state will be evaluating it, but so far the only information that we've had as far as waivers or exceptions have been towards this year's graduating class,
okay.
Which is why, you know, we just have to continue to inform everyone of what's available to them and what's happening down the road, because we really don't know. But as of, we have not received any notification that it wouldn't be a graduation requirement for non-seniors.
But he's definitely a non-senior, a freshman, taking geometry. So he will take the EOC in geometry this year. He still has to pass it.
He has to pass his course.
He has to pass the course. The four
for
quarters.
Geometry?
Yes, geometry.
Oh, I apologize. I thought you were asking about algebra.
Well, last year was algebra.
Okay.
This year, and I know he would have the geometry EOC would take the place of Algebra 1. But I just want to make it clear, especially for a lot of parents who had eighth graders last year moving into the high school realm, and then all of a sudden they are not seniors, what's going on? For example, if we have a freshman in a brand new high school and more academically established programs, it's a big difference between middle school and high school, those students might have been quarantined two or three times during the year, might have been sick themselves. What if, for example, that nice young man that I have in my family does not pass the EOC? Still, he will be required. So as well, it's fresh in his mind, when would our district be able to offer makeup course or refreshing for geometry so he can pass that EOC?
So I did want to clarify, geometry is part of the executive order that was discussed. The geometry, the scores will not be included in a student's course grade. So it's great for him to take it, but it will not penalize him if he doesn't do well. One thing to note, I mentioned scholar designation, so passing that may be a requirement for scholar designation somewhere down the road, but the geometry would be included in part of that EOC that will no longer count towards 30% of the student's grade for this year.
For this year, but he still will have to pass it to graduate.
No.
Geometry EOC is not a graduation requirement.
Okay. I just want to make sure that's very clear so we have no arguments in my house.
You can tell him his Nana won that for him.
So yes.
Nana won it.
Okay, so that would be a question I think that would be very nicely to put on our website,
Yeah. Okay. Especially
for 8th to 9th grade students, or even 5th grade to 6th grade students, those students who were left one level of education to another and who are faced with all kinds of different challenges. And I know our rising seniors, the class of 2022, oh my gosh, that class. And if we go back to normal, what will they be facing? Because they've had their sophomore and junior years affected. We will have to also brace for a lot of remediation to help them pass any of their exams, because all that will be in place for them when they graduate.
You're absolutely correct, and that's why I mentioned multiple times in my presentation that it applies to the graduating class of 2021. The EOCs is across the board for anyone in an EOC course, but the majority of the waivers applied are for our seniors, so we really do have to look ahead to those non-seniors and begin to plan for what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. Thank you. And again, you know, I was part of a statewide press conference with school board members, the president of Florida PTA and the president of the Florida Alliance of Schools, board members from across the state on March 9th, and we appealed to the governor as well as to Tom Leake, who is a state representative from our area. He does cover a lot of my own district because he had not scheduled any kind of that bill, the House bill that was to help our students in assessments. One other thing I think we need to do. Many people assume the test is like any other test, and it will always test the true abilities, knowledge of our students. But there are times when there are glitches. The practice is not what actually happens when the test occurs. Is there a way, and I don't know if this is what we always do, but is there a way to make sure that we talk to teachers who proctor the tests? I know they can't look over the shoulder, but what they hear, and also from what students experience, can we find out what our students are experiencing during the testing time in order to address the needs that they have when they sit down and take a test, especially if it's on a computer?
Yeah, I definitely think that's something we can look into is surveying the students' experiences within the limits of what we're allowed to ask them.
Yes.
But yeah, I definitely think that's something we can look into to try to improve the process.
I think it's very important that we know what is it that they are experiencing on test day. Mm-hmm. How different is their practice that we are told that whether it's the district or the state says this is our practice, and then on the day of the test, how different is it? Or if it's the same, or if everything that they were told ahead of time and practiced and learned in the school year, it was on the test and they were tested on what we thought they were going to be tested on. Because we all know as teachers, the test is a reflection of what was taught. And if the student hasn't learned what is on the test, then we can't be successful on that test. So, and tests occur, this is April, and doesn't it, like the FSA 8th grade, FSA ELA, for example, does it test on the whole year, or is it just an accumulation of what they've learned?
So that would be specific to the course. So, for example, FSA 8th grade, FSA ELA would be tested on the skills that they've learned throughout the year. However, 8th grade science would be tested on the skills that they've learned in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. That's a little more unique. Similar to 5th grade science is assessed on skills that they've learned throughout the year. But for the most part, it's assessing on the skills and standards that they have learned that year. For the most part.
Okay, so as our scores come out, when they took the test, which was last week, correct? And it was based on their entire eighth grade year. We started late. We started the end of August. Students might have been quarantined a couple of times. They might have been ill. So if we take a sampling of students whose grades are low or high, how much did they miss? How much of their school time was sacrificed because of the pandemic? Or results of the pandemic. Teachers are out. Staff is out. We didn't have our volunteers up until yesterday. So I would think we need to know the results of what this year caused to help us analyze as when our school results come back, that they don't fall squarely on the shoulders of our students, that they don't fall squarely on the shoulders of our teachers, or squarely on the schools themselves. As an English teacher myself, I always thought it was my fault because if my student failed the test, it was the test that was wrong or something that they just didn't learn. So I want to make sure we have a good look at actually what happened at the test during the test times.
I'd like to add to that if I could, Ms. Cuthbert. No, when we looked at our data, we just did our Goal 3 stock take with Ms. Rowland and her team, and one of the areas you know that we're looking at is attendance. And when we looked at that, we look at a metric of 10 days or more of a student missing. 29% of our students have missed 10 days or more this year. And so this is what I want us, as the adults, the ones that are in charge of our system, to adopt. And I want us, as parents of our children, to realize, yes, this has been a very different year. But even our best students have had learning loss. There is no question this has been a year of learning loss. Mm-hmm. This is a gift. And how we move forward with this gift in our hand is extremely important. We can go, whew, that was wonderful, and go forward like we always do. But I'm going to tell you, we're going to get caught next year when it comes time to assessment. Volusia County has taken a very, very aggressive approach of having a very extensive summer program, virtually brick and mortar for the month of June, for the month of July. It is for our students that need remediation. It's for acceleration for all of our students. We have got to make a really bigger effort than we ever have to get those students to continually be engaged in their learning through the summer. I'll give you an example. I really worry about our students that are in fourth grade this year. So the fourth graders this year, they went through, they missed their last quarter in third grade last year, mm-hmm. As a third grader, right? They moved on to fourth grade this year, and then this year, they've missed a lot of key components. And then next year, they're going to be the fifth graders going forward. Where that even carries on forward, if we don't catch them up in this next year, they'll start middle school behind. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we don't have students taking acceleration courses in middle school as we want, as we should. We should be trying to get most of our students through algebra in middle school. Because when they get through algebra in middle school, that means their opportunities in high school to take more rigorous courses are there, and then their future is wide open to them. But if we don't do that for this group of students that are currently fourth graders, we're going to have a whole bunch of students when they get to ninth grade that are going to be taking remediation courses. Mm-hmm. We've got to jump on this. We've shared our summer programs with the Futures Board. I've asked each member to put it out on their own personal websites. Our principals are going to reach out to these students in need, and we're going to ask them to personally invite students to the summer learning, and we're going to ask for some documentation. They're going to come in, and we're going to ask the principals to send documentation to their assistant superintendent when they ask a parent about summer programs and will they participate, what the parent says. Because we've really got to make this be an opportunity for us. It's not it's an opportunity. And for us to move forward, this is what we need. A couple board meetings ago, I stood here and I said to you that we're a better district than our numbers show. I believe that. But if we don't take this chance, we're not going to get out in front again. And it's the school districts that move forward with this opportunity that are going to be the ones that triumph years from now. So, Melanie, thank you very much. Any other questions for Melanie?
Thank you very much, Ms. Kester. Hello to your husband.
Thank you. And I did want to circle back to settle the debate in your households. You mentioned that he's in geometry this year and algebra last year. So keep in mind that somewhere along the way, he will need to pass the algebra EOC as a graduation requirement. So it might not be geometry, but as Dr. Fritz mentioned, that it could also be used as a concordance score. So okay. Sounds like it's a 50-50 on that argument.
Okay, thanks. We look forward to Algebra 1 tutoring. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Fritz, any others?
No, ma'am. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Okay, we have 12 minutes before we get to public participation at 5 o'clock. Next, we have a 1601 Human Resources update. Mr. West, if you are not done in 12 minutes, do I have your permission to interrupt you?
Yes, ma'am, you do. We will be done.
Okay.
Thank you,
all right.
I have Ms. Fields here with me today, and I'll be running the PowerPoint. She'll be talking.
Okay. All right, good afternoon. All right, we'll just start out with the vacancies. I'm just praying for the day. I'm wondering if there will ever be a moment in time where every single spot is filled, but I don't think there ever will be. But our numbers are pretty low. Right now, we are at instructional 59 people, and across the district in our support roles, we have 114 vacancies. Mm-hmm. We are hiring every day. April is a busy month for us. We have currently, we're in the middle of our transfer fair. At its height, we had 311 teachers enrolled in the transfer fair this year. So a lot of movement is happening every day. We're getting lots and lots and lots of movement, which is a good thing. Some teachers are moving from one school to another, opening spots, so that's even the displacements we have, which will be finalized later this week. It's diminishing, so that's a really good thing. We are using, we have a virtual transfer fair. I think Christy spoke about it in a prior school board meeting. It's working very well. Really good feedback from that, from the teachers, from the principals. It's really allowing them to get a good glimpse. People can put in video responses to all of their questions and then choose to follow up with a face-to-face or a team interview if they would like to. On Friday is our big day in HR. We would love for any of you to come to the Ocean Center to be with us. I've been blessed to be a part of it as a hiring team in the past, and it is an amazing day with excited young people ready to start in this profession. So we're really excited to meet them on Friday. So we will be there at 6:30. If you'd like to come join us for breakfast or later in the day, we would love to see you. And this year, it is two-part. There is a face-to-face component, which is the 16th, but there's also about half and half are attending virtually. And if they attend virtually, it begins on the 16th, but it continues through the end of the month. So that's a nice feature also. As mentioned, principals have indicated who they are displacing at their school. The number, as I said, it's decreased a little bit. It was 130 when I made the PowerPoint presentation yesterday. I believe about five more teachers have been added back into the mix, and that could continue. The largest number of displacements is because of VOL. They pretty much had to displace every single non-tenured teacher going back to their home schools. So on Thursday, another fun day of a very fun week, we will be sitting in a room, a whole team, and we will know at that point what our vacancies are of that moment, and we will try to pair up all of those displaced folks in their area of certification as close to home as we possibly can. We will be communicating both with the schools and the teachers involved immediately as we're doing it on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And I did want to talk a little bit about LOAs. It has been quite the process. We have been in contact at its height. This was 209 was how many leave of absences we sent letters to earlier in the year, and these are pretty much people who had taken a leave of absence for the whole year. 100 of those persons have indicated that they do want to come back to us next year. Their schools know and have created a spot for them. Some have chosen not to come back to us. That's the 36. A further 45 have extended their leave of absence into next year for either the whole year or for a piece of the year, and we are still trying every method we know how to get in contact with a few that have yet to make contact with us. Mm-hmm. And finally, another event. We do not have a firm date yet, but we would like to invite you to we are going to have a celebration for our retired and retiring persons. We are making plans for it to be at the Jackie Robinson Memorial Ballpark sometime in the month of May. We're just coordinating that date, and we will send you invitations as soon as we know the clear date.
So just to kind of wrap up, thank you, Ms. Haynes, for mentioning last week on Tuesday we had our first year Teacher of the Year celebration, and we were very excited. We had all of our schools represented there with their first year teachers, and we were able to have that celebration at the Jackie Robinson Stadium. It was a great event. We actually did that, and Ms. Mahaney, with the help of Futures and The View, we'd like to thank them for definitely sponsoring that event. But we basically kind of want to roll that out, and we're excited about this retirement reception that we're looking at because, frankly, we did not have the opportunity to acknowledge our retirees last year because of course, the COVID situation. But we are looking forward to doing something at Jackie Robinson this year for those folks. So we have a lot going on. This is a busy time of the year for us, of course. We're very excited about this Friday because, remember, what we've been shooting for this whole year is identifying what our true vacancies are so that Friday our principals will know very clearly this is who we can hire when these bright young teachers come in onto the Ocean Center on this Friday for recruitment purposes. So we're very excited about that. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about that.
Yes, Ms. Haynes, just a second.
Yes, so, Mr. West, I just want to piggyback on what you said because this was going to be one of my questions. Since we did not have anything last year for the retirees,
yes.
Are they being invited to this year's, or is this just the ones that are retiring this year? Because I have a real
right.
I understand what we were under last year.
Yes, ma'am.
Some of those people that retired last year had dedicated 20, 25, 30, mm-hmm. 35, 40 years of their lives, and it's not at any fault of their own that we weren't right. able to celebrate them. And so I just don't, and I apologize, but I don't know if we've looked at that, but I would like, if at all possible, to see, can we invite back those that retired last year that we did not get to honor?
So I will say we had that conversation. There was a lot of discussion about this. And one of the things that we talked about was maybe looking back at the date of when the actual last year retirements were. I mean, I don't know how far we can extend back into the year last year, but maybe we can look at the end of the year, how many folks were, and I believe that what we had anticipated was those folks that were retired at the end of last year, correct? And that number does include those as well.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, from March to the end of the year.
So this includes from March of last year.
Of last year. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
We'll be invited.
The end of this year.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I really appreciate that because that was one of the tough things with that. There was nothing we could do at the time. You know,
right.
we could not hold anything, but I'm happy to hear that you're including them in that. And then I had, because sometimes, you know, questions come up to us, and so I just wanted to clarify a few things. I do appreciate all the work that you're doing with the transfer fair and, you know, that you're doing it virtually and things like that. Like, I think those are positive things because I think it allows... You know, people aren't driving around having to meet and all that. And so I see that as a very positive. But so right now what you're doing is you are transferring teachers that are in good
yes.
standing. And that's the first thing that's going to happen. Then you said this Thursday you're going to go in to start handling all displacements
yes.
to match displacements to schools.
Yes.
So do displacements just include those that sometimes, you know, we had 6 first grade units, and now we're down to 5 because our, you know, our enrollment has changed, and the teacher's in great standing, but lots of times we know it's the last person in the door,
yes.
and you're looking for a place for them. But does that also include non-reappointees for the displacements, or is that...
Now, those are 2 separate groups, so if
right.
a teacher was displaced, they were invited into the transfer fair because it happens first.
Okay.
If they're not able to find a position during the transfer fair with their 5 chosen schools or their area, then they would be placed on the Thursday. If a person is non-reappointed, then they have been invited to the job fair on Friday.
Okay. So first we're handling transfers, people that chose.
Yes.
And said, I'd like to make a change because maybe I lived on the west side of the county and now I live on the east. I got married and come over there.
Yes.
Next, you're handling displacements. But if they were displaced, they were invited into the transfer.
Yes.
Fair. But if they didn't make a match, then you're handling them on Thursday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day on Thursday, when we move into Friday, Friday will be brand new people that are coming into education.
Yes.
Or coming to Volusia County and non-reappointments.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
It's open hire. Yes, ma'am.
All right. I just wanted to be.
Yes. Thank you.
I've heard people batting around different things, and I just wanted it to be clear.
Yeah, it's hard because there's lots of different words. Yes, we fielded a lot of questions, as you can imagine.
But thank you for answering that.
Do you mind if we suspend this for a little bit so we can have our. Our public participation, 5 o'clock certain. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right back. Ms. Schultz, do we have any cards? Thank you. Thanks very much. All right, we have three that are asking for public participation to express their views. So I'm going to call Davina Underwood first, and then Anna Harmon, and then after Anna will be Elizabeth Albert. Have a seat. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Please state your name.
Davina Underwood.
And tell us where you're from, and you have 3 minutes. You'll notice your time is on the TV there.
You started already. Ormond Beach, Florida. I'm the proud mother of 3 daughters who will be attending Pine Trail Elementary, one who currently is there. I'm a certified school counselor, and I bittersweetly chose to resign from Deltona Middle School as the lead school counselor in 2015 to stay home and raise my children. I'm an advocate for the public school system, as both my husband and I dedicated our degrees in education. I'm here today to address the decision of Superintendent Dr. Fritz to designate LGBTQ+ Mental Health Awareness Week without the approval or vote of the school board. I stand with a very large group of moms who have committed to teach our children unconditional love, respect, and acceptance of people no matter their differences. We can and do teach this without being complicit in accepting what goes against our family's beliefs. We want our voice to be heard when we say we are not against anyone, but we are for parental rights. We are advocates for our children and their education. We firmly believe things like religion, politics, sexuality, morals, and values are topics that should be taught in the home. This is not the role of the teachers, and they are not being paid for this type of education. They are trained and trusted to teach on core subjects and barely have enough time to meet those required standards. LGBT awareness does not belong in the public school setting, as I've heard echoed by teachers, administrators, and parents through the last 2 weeks. Instead of this week unifying and supporting as intended, it certainly does the opposite by isolating individuals and shining a harsh spotlight on their differences. Being that the LGBT Awareness Week was introduced hastily this year, many parents are rightfully concerned about what this entails going forward. How is this Awareness Week going to be taught for all the years to come? How is this even considered an Awareness Week when literally zero awareness is being taught? I'm certain that the LGBT community can certainly agree that putting a title on a calendar does not bring awareness to anything. It seems that this is a political agenda that's being forced onto our students by a small group of people when the vast majority of interest holders feel it has no place in public education. I would challenge the school board to take a poll and to conduct an unbiased survey to get the vote from parents and educators asking for their input. My main concern is that this LGBT Health Awareness Week is just the beginning. When does the Awareness Week transition into advocacy and promotion? I want to come to you today with a solution that I feel would meet the needs of all students. If we're truly worried about all students, we should implement a week of mental health awareness that umbrellas all issues our children have. Each school could offer age-appropriate mental health education through school counselors with signed parental consent. In the previous board meeting, we were told that LGBT students represent 4% of the student population, but what about the other 90%, 6%?
Thank you. Please send that to our superintendent, what solution you have. We'd be more than glad to read it. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you. Go Wolves. Please, we're here to agree to disagree. We're here to respect everyone's views. We're not clapping for one view or the other. Thank you very much for expressing your view. Ms. Anna Hannon and then Ms. Elizabeth Albert. Hello, Ms. Hannon. You have 3 minutes. Please speak into the microphone so we can all hear you. And state your name and the area from which you're from.
My name is Anna Hannon, H-A-N-N-O-N. I'm from Ormond Beach. My son attends Seabreeze. I want to express my concern about the power of the school board. This year, I've learned that the school board does not have anyone in authority that they are held accountable to or over them, other than their constituents, not the county council, not the Board of Education, not the state representatives. There is no chain of command. So I was deeply concerned when the mask policy was implemented. The school board was somehow allowed to make a health mandate when the school board is supposed to be in place to make education decisions. This year, the board used their position, overstepping the parents and asserting themselves above doctors in creating a mask mandate. The rationale? You are following the CDC guidelines and the health department. We didn't elect them. The CDC has other recommendations that have not been made mandatory in order to receive a public education, such as the annual flu shot. Our schools opened when the CDC was not yet recommending that. You opened because of our governor's orders. However, when our governor's orders say no penalties for not wearing a mask, you say that doesn't apply to schools. The face covering policy is a hoop that must be jumped through in order to attend in-person school. What happens when the CDC recommends the COVID emergency use authorization experimental vaccine for children? And by the way, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was paused today by the FDA because of serious blood clots. Per your current rationale, how can we know that you won't create a policy that children must have the COVID shot in order to attend school, and that you'll then say, No Vaccine Passport Act, which is also being introduced at the federal level, doesn't apply to our schools? If CDC recommendation is all that is needed to defend a policy, then there is too much power within the school board. This past week, one of the district's administrators replied in an email that those students who are vaccinated will not have to quarantine from contact tracing, while those unvaccinated will still have to quarantine. The excessive quarantines have been inconsistent, and all of this reeks of medical choice discrimination. You have also said that if you choose to veer away from the CDC recommendation, you would need a medical advisory board to consult with, to which I again say, those are not our elected officials. And if such a panel is created, we who are against medical mandates want a parent clinician seat at the table. An advisory board without such representation should not get to weigh in on a mandate of a medical device for my child. This is your constituents holding you accountable for the extreme overreach and the parents that stand together to say, never again should a policy such as this be permissible.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please, one more time, please. Please. Ms. Elizabeth Albert, you are our last participant this evening.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the board, Dr. Fritz, members of the audience. Well, first I'd like to provide a point of clarification regarding the displacements that I know Mr. West, Ms. Hazel, and Ms. Fields are well aware of. Before any new hires can come into the district, all of those who have been displaced must be placed first. And I know that they're going to do that, but I just wanted to make sure that you knew that that is contractual. What I'd like to speak with you about for the majority of my time tonight is a VAM situation. And I do want to publicly thank Dr. Fritz for exercising his flexibility and providing that relief from any potential negative impacts to instructional and administrative summative scores. We do appreciate that. However, there are some clarifications that I do need to receive, and not tonight in this public forum, but we do need to have this work addressed. Clarifications such as, what are the potential impacts in subsequent years? What are the impacts to teachers who are not in the testing grades? What does it mean for them? How will this translate if for some terrible reason they bring back performance pay and we have to look at those scores, right? So these are things that I'd like to have some work done. And then ultimately, I think that we absolutely need to codify this in the form of an MOU. And so that will put it all down in writing. It will be clear. It will be understandable. And we'll all be marching in the same direction. So I hope you're supportive of that. And then I'm going to ask the million-dollar question. I hope that it was somewhere slated to be discussed later this evening. But we need some direction on Volusia Live. We have surrounding districts who have publicly made statements about what they're planning to do with or not do with an innovative model for the coming year, and so I think we deserve to have some conversation about that as well. And then finally, Mrs. Cuthbert, whatever you need, your union family is here for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. We appreciate all that who attend and who express their views. They're very, very important. We do not take them lightly. It's all something that I know that as we discuss here on the dais, it weighs very heavily on all of us. And as my husband was at an administrator at Deltona High for about 6 years, a little ways ago, we still have pictures of wolves all over our house. And so, but thank you for your service, for all of you being great advocates for your children. So may we have Mr. West back again to, and I think there are a couple other questions. Thank you, ladies, very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have
I think
a
Mr. Cologne has one. For
yes,
you.
Mr. Cologne.
Question for Mr. Wester, just because it's come up a lot. What happens when a teacher last year, for example, went to VLL and they've taught at the school where they're at forever, and now they find themselves without somewhere to go back? Their principals are saying, you know, I ended up in January accepting a VOL teacher who needed to be placed. And so now you no longer can return to your school. While this person's been there 15 years and now finds themselves looking for another job where both the principal may want to bring them back because this is home for them, and at the same time, cannot displace the person who's only been there for a few months. Can you explain that for so that folks understand what is our process policy? Because I think that question's been asked of me several times, and I think folks don't quite understand what the algorithm for how this is all taking place. Again, this is all COVID-related. I don't believe this is anybody wanting to do harm to anybody. I just, you know, it's not often you have so many teachers shift over to an online platform due to a pandemic and then back. So I just, if we could just get some clarity for the folks who are listening who are in that situation and some are really, really hurt by it.
Sure. So, and as you said, this past year was unusual in just the number of the number of transfers and the number of the amount of movement that we had in the middle of the year. What we look at, though, is that the appointments or the assignments that we have are annual assignments. They're for the year. And we recognize that we're going to have, and we have a unit loss process in place that has been contractually agreed upon with the union as well in regards to, and that's the displacement process. And as Ms. Albert did mention, we make sure that every teacher that is displaced has a position, has a place to go before we open any hiring for our external, you know, candidates in that particular area. So the obligation that we have is to make sure that everyone does have a spot. This year, with the increase in VOL and the opportunity that teachers took advantage of to actually get to VOL to be able to teach virtually and in that platform, which was a great opportunity for a number of them, For some of them, it will continue because we do know that those VOL numbers are not going to shrink completely down to the way it was. So we have actually allocated a number of units to VOL. They will still be much larger than they were last year at the beginning, or last year pre-COVID, I'll put it that way. So we will still have a number of VOL teachers there, but we will have the VOL is where we had the most displacements because that's where we had the biggest excess in teachers this year. And the agreement was is that that would be for the year. And once that, basically we shrunk back down, those folks who were in VOL are given the opportunity. That's why we have so many of them in the transfer fair right now. We're giving them all the opportunity to find their own position, as Emma said, to see what's a school that's convenient and close to them. If they're not able to find that position they want, we will make sure that they're placed on the 15th. So while I recognize that some of those folks might have been, I'm going to say, caught when they left to go to VOL and not be able to go back to the exact position they were at or maybe even the same school that they were at because that vacancy has already been filled with a displaced teacher, that displacement process is what we have in place to make sure that all of our teachers have positions, and it's a protection for them as well. So even those folks who are in VOL right now finding a spot.
So is the displacement process that you're describing in the MOU the same as it is usually every year?
Yes, actually, that part isn't part of the MOU. It's actually in our contract that
right.
The displacement process will take place.
That's where I'm challenged, because this is not a normal year. This is not a normal contract. And if a principal said, give you an example. I know one school where there's a fourth grade teacher, was there forever. It came time, somebody needed to go, and she said, you know what, I'll go. She said, I'll go. Went to another school. Okay, like I said, new teacher from VOL, came in January. They would love to have her back, but the principal wasn't given the choice to bring her back.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the contract.
Yes.
But that was pre-COVID.
Well,
pre all of this.
I understand, and I think Ms. Albert would actually agree with me on this, in the fact that, are you shaking your head yes or no, Elizabeth? I'm dying to see this. She says yes. Okay, good to hear. What we base our displacement process on is unit losses. So it would be very difficult if we didn't, because then, frankly, principals would say, well, Carl, I want you this year, but Reuben, I don't want you, so see ya, and I'll pull somebody else in. And the contract is in place to make sure that if we have unit losses and we have a vacancy in a particular area, the principal will be able to bring in someone if a displaced teacher isn't placed there. So it is in a protection for our teachers and to give them the opportunity to make sure that we're able to place our teachers and have places for each one of them. So that's why we actually have that contract in place in the process.
But as a principal, you hired Carl. You didn't hire the VOL teacher who showed up in January. And so, again, I'm just trying to get us to understand, and maybe I'm off base. If I am, please tell me. I struggle with someone who really found themselves fearful,
mm-hmm.
who are now vaccinated, who have been at a school for 12, 15 years. Their principals want them back and are being told, sorry. And so
have a position for them, correct?
Well, because someone else has been in that position for a very short period of time.
But they don't have a position for them. And I think that's the kind of key that I want to portray. And I'm not trying to pinpoint on that, but I am trying to say that we're trying to be very careful to make sure that we have positions for all of our teachers. And if I go into that teacher, by the way, there's just as many people who have been in our district for, let's say, 20 years that I had to place that was displaced into a position that if I go and that principal says, well, I don't want you here anymore, well, then I'm going to have a very seasoned teacher who may be very good, displaced because I wanted to bring my VOL teacher back. So we just have to be very careful and look at each one of those situations. We're trying to find a place for everyone.
And that's trying to match. That's what I'm asking for.
Understood.
Because I understand
completely.
The contract pre-COVID.
Yes, sir.
But I think there are situations where, and again, this one teacher said, you know what? The other teachers are new. I'm seasoned. You know what? I can handle going to another school for a year. I can handle that. I can do that.
Right.
And so I just think, you know, if our principals had the opportunity to say, you know, hey, this was the scenario, you know, if they were a part of that conversation, which I'm not, I mean, I may be wrong, maybe they were. If they were a part of that conversation, there may be some situations that folks are caught in the crack and we may not be offering the most grace and compassion possible.
Okay.
And so that's all I'm asking is, I get that there's a said contractual process,
right.
But there are real folks who were really, really scared last year.
Absolutely.
And
sure.
At the same fashion, these folks stepped up for us to go to VOL mm-hmm. to handle that. So I appreciate them all, but someone who went from a classroom to teaching online when we needed them most, it just feels wrong.
The problem is this. While you would tell one person yes, you're telling someone else no. And, you know, while I understand your concerns and what you're trying to do, that would open up a whole can of worms for us across this district because there is not a process. It would be allowed to an individual to make that decision. And a public organization like ours that has a bargaining unit, we have rules and processes that we have to follow. And so the situation you're talking about, a VOL teacher could truly bump if we allowed that to happen, a veteran teacher that has been at the school for a long time based on a decision by a principal not following that process. And that would cause us a lot of grief and headache over time. You have to have a process when it comes to placing staff. You're right, Mr. Colon. People did what we asked them to do out of grace and compassion, out of fear because of being in brick and mortar. As much as we possibly can get people back to the assignments that they want to be in, we will certainly try to do that. Yes. But we still have to follow a process or you're opening yourself up to unfair labor practices with current employees sitting in those positions. So,
very good. And we will work on the grace and compassion piece, absolutely, because we recognize that. Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. West? Okay, and then as soon as we're finished, we're going to take a 10-15 minute break before we go into our board action items.
I feel your pain, and I can understand what that teacher's going through. And yeah. At the same time, though, I had more teachers than I can count on two hands ask me before they were going to make that decision to go mm-hmm. to VOL. Their main thing was, will I get back to my same school if I do this? And mm-hmm. I said, no. I mean, maybe.
No guarantees.
But
right.
If the principal has a vacancy and right. you're certified in it, then and your principal likes you and mm-hmm. you had a good relationship, then if all those things are right. there, then, yeah, you probably would. But
right.
if there aren't any openings, then you can't take the place of somebody else who's already at that school because that's not fair to that teacher. And then their comeback usually is, yeah, but I've been teaching 20 years at that school. And mm-hmm. then, well, you know, no one's forcing you out of that school. You're putting in your application to go to a VOL. So it's just hard. I mean, it's just hard all the way around. And I know there are principals right now who probably are struggling with the displaced teacher side of things. The transfer thing is much easier because you know
yes.
the people who want to come to your school. You have a chance yes. to interview and see them and check out and all
right.
that. But now the time period gets really crunched, and I know that call that you make, and you say, Carl, we have three people we need to place, and, you know, it's Jane, Dick, and Tom, and so, you know, that's a tough one, and because every principal wants to be able to hire the people that
they want.
They're going to work at their school. Right. They want that opportunity. They want to be able to go to that job fair with two or three vacancies, you know, clear vacancies. I think it's just a tough thing, and you have to think about it system wide, because otherwise, it'd just be chaos.
Yes,
you'd have so many hurt feelings and mad people.
Thank you, Mr. Persis.
Thank you,
Ms. Burnett.
Thank you. On the vacancies, we've decreased those a lot, it looks like. I know you probably can't get this to me today, but it would be okay to get later. Are you able to get me a breakdown of where these are in relation to each school?
Yes,
like,
ma'am.
So maybe all 10 of these ESE teachers are at one school. So or just for an example, I know that's not the case, but just if you could get me a breakdown.
We absolutely can. I will also say those are the vacancies as of right now. More importantly, what we're looking at is the vacancies for next year.
Okay.
So that's what we're focusing on coming up, because that's the part that we're going to have for all of our applicants. Well, first of all, we're going to have it for our displaced teachers this Thursday, okay? And then, of course, we will have it for our principals and our new applicants on Friday. So, yes, ma'am, that's what we're actually focusing on right now. So, yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Any others?
I just wanted to say, do you have any idea yet of the number of teachers that you've invited to the Friday job fair? You know, like for people that are new, do you have like a number of how many are coming?
Yes, that's on your on the list. I'm sorry, it was on the slide that said we've got about 150? Is that right, Emma? I'm sorry. About 150 coming face-to-face. Then we have about another 150 that are going to be coming virtually, or that have signed up virtually, yes, ma'am.
All right, and I want to piggyback off of what Mr. Persis said, because I had several teachers reach out to me in August that, you know, thought they would like to go to VOL, but because there was no guarantee that they could come back to their school, they chose not to go. And, you know, anytime you make a change, and I did in my career, you know, I left elementary and went to high school at one point. Well, you know, after I taught at high school a couple of years, I didn't think that I could just walk right back. I mean, I had to go in and apply for what positions were open. And the same thing, like when you go out and do like a grant position, you know, they're typically funded 1 year or 2 years. Mm-hmm. Whenever I stepped out and did that, I knew that, you know, at the end of 1 or 2 years, that may no longer be funded. And I would then have to find a new place. And you know, like, otherwise I would have said, I want to go back to Enterprise, you know, because that's where I started and all of that. But it's hard. But, you know, as everybody has said, there has to be a process. And so when people made those decisions, you know, there was no guarantee that they were going to come back. Like, we'd love to be able to guarantee everything. But at the same time, you have to look at the person that already stepped in and took that position. And, you know, if they're already a tenured teacher or whatever, we can't turn around and say to them, well, thanks for coming in and filling in this year, but, you know, you're the one now because I want to bring somebody else back. And so I know there are people like you that they chose to stay where they were because that's where they wanted to be, and they didn't want to risk it after a year. So,
right.
So thank you.
Thank you. I just want to plug for the retirement reception.
Yes, ma'am.
I know a lot of teachers think it's, you know, why go out that. I attended, and I loved it back in 2012. It just gave me a finality.
Closure.
It gave me closure. And also I was able to see others who were retiring across the district, and I was amazed. I've made many good friends. And so I encourage all teachers who have decided that this is the year that they're going to go out and have lunch on Tuesday at 11:45 if they so choose.
Yes.
I think we need to celebrate. them. Absolutely. And so I encourage all of them to attend this retirement celebration in May. So thank you very much, Mr. West.
We're very excited about that. So thank you.
We will reconvene in 15 minutes at 5:45. Thank you so much. We're back at 5:45. Thank you for waiting for us. We are now going on to our board action items, 17.01. Dr. Fritz.
I'd like to call Mr. Penley forward for revision of our policy regarding open enrollment and choice.
Thank you, Dr. Fritz, Madam Chair, members of the board. We're bringing forward tonight item 1701, seeking the board's authorization to advertise an amendment to policy 203, which is our school choice policy. There are no significant changes here except to move the window for application from the day after winter break through March 1st. So it just gives a little more planning time for capacity budget for the next school year. So with that, unless there are any questions, we will advertise that policy if it's the board's pleasure, and most likely put that on for the May 11th or May 25th meeting dates.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Penley? Okay. May I have a motion? Then, Dr. Fritz?
The superintendent enthusiastically recommends the approval of this policy to allow more choice and more time for our parents to make those decisions in our school district.
Okay, is there a motion?
Motion to approve the policy advertising.
Okay, there's a motion been made by Mr. Ruben Colon. Is there a second?
I second the motion.
Okay, and Ms. Haynes has seconded the motion. Is there any more discussion? Thank you, Mr. Penley, for bringing us all up to date on all of this. It was very well self-explained. Thank you for this new amendment to School Board Policy 203. All those... I'm sorry, what?
No.
Okay, any other discussion? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against, please say nay. Thank you, Mr. Penley. The motion has been passed unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you. And 17.02, okay, and I'm going to give this one over to Mr. Doran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While I'm making the initial presentation, with your permission, could I invite Mr. Shinoff up from California?
Certainly. It's nice to have a West Coaster around.
There we go.
That's not easy.
William Shinoff is an attorney, and he's with the France Law Group out of California. I told him he could appear by phone or presentation in some other format, but he said we were way too important for that. He was going to fly out here just to answer any questions and make sure everybody was comfortable with what we were proposing. He approached me a couple months ago and with this, and I thought it was a pretty good thing. I went to the superintendent. He was open to it. I went to our general counsel, and he gave it his blessing. So now we have it here before you to discuss and possibly approve. The short of it is we're looking at joining with many other districts, the number of which Mr. Shinoff can, I'm sure, share with us, and around the country who are focused on the losses that they've incurred and the harm that has been incurred by school districts around the country due to vaping. And he even has a little bit of extra news that just broke here recently, today or yesterday or something like that. So he'll share that with you. Let me just turn it over to Mr. Shinoff, who can give us a little overview and then certainly answer any questions.
Thank you all very much for the opportunity to speak with you this evening. As Mr. Doran said, my name is William Shinoff. I'm an attorney with the France Law Group, and I'm out of our San Diego, California office. Prior to joining the France Law Group, I myself was an education law attorney for nearly 10 years representing school districts in Southern California. And during the end of my tenure in representing school districts, the issue of vaping was coming up across all my clients. It was taking up a lot of staff time, and it was becoming a major disruption in the learning environment. When I came to the France Law Group, I saw this as an opportunity as specializing in representing public entities, but now on the plaintiff side, to see if we could tackle this issue and potentially provide the resources for school districts to appropriately handle this issue. To let you understand how these cases work, this is not a class action. This is what we call a mass action. So each school district that's involved in this case will have their own lawsuit on file. And how the federal courts handle this type of issue is when there are many plaintiffs alleging the same legal issues, alleging very similar damages, the courts coordinate it into one courtroom in order to avoid litigation that would go on for the next 30 years. So that's happened in this case. It's what's called a multi-district litigation, and we're venued in the Northern District of California in San Francisco in front of a great judge. His name's Judge Orrick. We've been litigating this case now for almost 18 months at this point. My firm represents over 250 school districts in 22 states. We started off with just the school districts in California and has grown exponentially. And what we're alleging in this case and what we truly believe the discovery is going to show in this case is that these two main defendants, there's Juul Labs, which was based out of San Francisco and now is out of Washington, D.C., and Altria, which many of you may know as Marlboro, they intentionally targeted the youth. They sold their products. They used the exact same marketing scheme that was done by the tobacco companies over 30 years ago, which led to the tobacco litigation. And we now have children who are addicted to the product because when they went out and put their product out on the market, they made it look as though, and they were exactly saying, is that it was safe, and they weren't advising the harms of the product, about the extent and the amount of nicotine that there is in the product. So to understand it, one of the Juul pods that is in the device is the equivalent of two packs of cigarettes. And what they've also done is when you're smoking cigarettes, you can only smoke so many until physically your body just won't let you. So they invented a salt that they put into the device that allows you to be able to inhale as much as you want without any physical effect. So you could literally in one sitting do an entire pod, and all of a sudden you've done two packs of cigarettes. And that is extremely harmful and extremely harmful for children. And so based on this and based on their marketing scheme and now the effect of that, what we're seeing on school campuses, we've brought these lawsuits. And what we're trying to deal with in this lawsuit is not only provide the monetary needs for school districts to deal with this in the future, but also to create change. A lot of change that happens in this country is through litigation. And so first I want to explain to you how the monetary component of this case works. So under two theories of negligence and public nuisance, we have the right to claim damages for school districts. First, what we do is we look backwards. So we go and we look at, you know, has the district, what steps have they taken to deal with this issue? You know, some districts have already went and installed vape detectors. Well, that's money that should never have had to be expended, and so we're going to get them reimbursed for that. Some districts have already went on and started putting on professional educational programs and have to spend general fund money to do that, get them reimbursed for that. One thing that I can tell you that every district has had to deal with is staff time dealing with vaping on campus, whether that be supporting students that are dealing with this issue or the unfortunate discipline that's coming with this. And so we work with each one of our clients in trying to determine how much staff time to date has been spent dealing with this vaping issue. And then we have our experts calculate how much public funds have been spent to date dealing with that through this staff time. And so that's a past economic harm that's been suffered by these districts. Then under a theory of public nuisance, so that these companies have caused a harm to the community, have caused a harm that now the district is dealing with, under that theory, you have a right to remedy, abate that nuisance. And so we're working with our experts in determining what do we need, what do these school districts need in order to be able to fight this issue and be able to properly support the students. And so what we're focused on is three parts: deterrence, support, and education. So what our experts have told us, one way we can help deter vaping on campus is by the installation of vape detectors in bathrooms and in school buses. A lot of districts are not able to do it just because of the cost. What I can tell you is that the cost of installing a vape detector can take anywhere between $2,000 to $5,000 a bathroom. So even for a small school district, that's a lot of money to come out of a general fund to deal with that issue. So that's what we're going to be claiming in this case, the need for that. Another part we're looking at is the need for further staffing, for support, and to be able to put further eyes on campus. So what we're looking at is a 5 to 10 year damage model to go and provide funding for your district to go and hire additional staff on your middle school and high school campuses so children are aware that there are staff members that are going to be looking out for this issue. Another factor is the support. We need to be able to support students that are now dealing with nicotine addiction and the ramifications of nicotine addiction. And what our experts have told us is be able to provide funding for districts to be able to hire additional counselors at their middle schools and high schools that can help kids that are dealing with nicotine addiction and dealing with the social and emotional issues that come with nicotine addiction. And then finally, what I think is the most important is education. As we've seen in the past, education is key to combat issues like this, as we saw with DARE. So what we're looking at is providing, again, 5 to 10 years worth of funding to be able to put on educational programs for students and parents on the harms of vaping. That's what our, at this point, that's what our experts have told us is, these are the elements you need to look at, this is how we need to fund this issue, and that's the best way that school districts can combat this issue, because unfortunately, this is an issue that's not going away. And what I can tell you is that it is an issue in your county. Your county, your health departments all over the country have been studying this issue for about the past 5 years. And recently, your county put out information on a survey that they did, that they went and studied children under 18. So these are people that should not have access to this product since they're not of legal age. Between the age of 11 and 17, they were asked, you know, within the past 30 days, how many of you have tried a Juul product, a vaping device? 30% said that they had, and that's a large number. Then they asked, well, how many of you are doing this on a daily basis? 24% said that they're doing that on a daily basis. These are all minors. And so what we're dealing with is an issue of they've created a product that is easily hidden, that cannot be found at all times, but we know that's being done. And so we need to be able to provide that support to the children to be able to make the right decisions, to be able to combat an issue of a company that intentionally marketed their product to kids and are now have immensely profited off the backs of children. So that's the monetary component of what we're looking to get for each one of our school district clients. And then the other factor is creating change. And so in litigation, we create change not by only holding these companies financially responsible, but by also requesting relief from the court. And we do that through what's called injunctive relief, and that's a court order to stop conduct. And so what we're doing is taking exactly what was done in the tobacco litigation, where the tobacco litigation, what resulted was restrictions on how they can market their product. So they cannot market their products intentionally to children, and they have to be honest about what's the contents of their product. So now that is what we're trying to get in this case, is to make sure that they stop marketing their products to children and also putting more clear warnings on their product of what these products contain. So that's what we're looking to do in this case. And to wrap up what I'm talking about here, I want to provide you two questions I end up getting from school boards every time I present on this matter.
How much?
That's definitely one of them. And one of them is also, one is time commitment of the staff to be involved in this case. So because this is a multi-district litigation, this is not like traditional litigation that school districts unfortunately have to deal with from time to time. So there's not going to be the depositions, the mass document production. All that's going to be required of your district to be involved in this case is to respond to what we call a discovery questionnaire. And that's about 30 to 35 yes or no questions and provide the supporting documents. So the staff time to be involved in this case is minimal, and that's because we already have selected plaintiff school districts to be the representatives of a trial that's going to be occurring in March 2022. And Florida has one of the school districts that's going to be that, and that's going to be Broward School District. They're going to be one of the representative cases that we're moving forward with. So the time commitment to be involved shouldn't be an issue. The other question is cost, the cost to be involved in this case. We handle this case on what's called a contingency fee basis. So that means we're not charging the district an hourly fee. We're not charging the district for the cost would come from a contingent based on the result. So what that means is if at any point we lose the case down the road, whether it be via a motion or at trial, I do not come back to the district to get reimbursed for my time or costs. The only way we're paid is through a financial outcome for the district. And how that works is a percentage of the financial outcome. Normally, plaintiff litigation would be 40% of the financial outcome, but what my firm has done is we've cut our fee. So if the case resolves within the first 6 months, it's 20%, and then any time thereafter, it's 25%. And so the fees are capped at 25%. And so that's where it would come from. So the bottom line is not a penny of general funds of the district would be used in this case. It can only bring in funds to the district as a result of this case. With that being said, I want to provide the opportunity. Oh, and Ms. Dorn said there was a recent update to this case. So what happened at the end of last year, all the defendants brought motions to dismiss on the school district's cases, claiming that school districts don't have a right to bring these cases, they've suffered no harm. The judge denied those motions. But what he did grant was their motion to dismiss a RICO claim, which is a racketeering. It's a criminal claim, but in the civil courts we can make that claim, and it's punitive in nature. But it's the same type of elements that you would claim in a criminal case. But the judge left the door open for us to try to bring that again. We did, and as of an hour and a half ago, he's now letting us move forward with a RICO claim against Altria and Juul and their directors, which is a very big deal in this type of case. This is exactly what happened in opioid litigation. It's exactly what happened in tobacco litigation. So it is a big accomplishment for us to get that involved in this case. So with that being said, I want to provide the opportunity to answer any questions you all may have.
Thank you. It was very clear, very much in layman's terms. I understood it. So thank you very much, sir. Are there any questions from the board? Mr. Colon.
I just want to point out, I'm looking at Bloomberg. Juul was valued at $38 billion in 2018. And you know, there's no question that every principal who's listening to this right now is going. And so I am supportive of this. Just to be clear, how much will it cost our district to be a part of this?
Zero.
Thank you. And so as a board member and as a proud respiratory therapist, I am in full support.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. Mrs. Burnett.
Thank you. I noticed in the contract there was wording about if there was non-monetary rewards, we would still have a fee. What does that look like?
So that is talking about if there is so for example, what's happened in the tobacco litigation, there ended up a pool of money that schools could come to. Then that would be something that you could gain for the next future, but that wouldn't be money that you would get at that moment the case resolves. So that's the type of that's what we're talking about. So there's a fee on that, but that would be down the road when the district's getting that money.
Okay.
So that's what it's focused on.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Haynes.
I appreciate you coming and explaining it. I had participated in some previous discussions about this that the Florida School Board Association had put out based on some of the other counties in Florida that were having these same issues. And so I found it to be very clear, and you know, and the marketing that was done did target our kids, you know, and I don't think parents even understood, you know, what could happen with their children doing this, because you know, nowhere in there did it say, but unfortunately we've seen, you know, if as you read the news stories and everything, we've seen children that have lost their lives or, you know, or to the point that they need lung transplants and things like that. And so I appreciate what your firm's doing. Thank you.
Yeah. And the truth is we're just at the beginning.
Yeah.
And we don't really know at this point what the long-term health effects are.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know what the long-term health effects was of cigarettes. And that took a long time to see. And so, unfortunately, I think that's the road we're going down.
Mm-hmm. And it could be a lot worse, too.
Correct. Yes.
Mr. Persis, do you have any questions, sir?
Well, I was just thinking, when the cigarette tobacco lawsuits were all taking place, the plaintiffs were individuals, right? Wasn't that a class action?
There was plaintiffs, as there are in this. There are individuals.
Yeah.
But there was also, in that case, there was the state, there was counties, and there were schools, too.
Okay.
And Florida was a big one.
A big one, yes.
Involved
yes,
in that.
Yes, yes. So you've just answered my question. Now, with tobacco, now with vaping, are there individuals doing the same thing?
Yes, they are. They're on a different track, though, in the courtroom.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we move on, Ms. Schultz, are there any questions from the public?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for traveling so far.
No problem.
It's nice to see the sunrise.
Yes.
It's only 20 minutes east. You can see the sunrise tomorrow morning. Okay. Dr. Fritz.
The superintendent recommends taking legal action to stem e-cigarette use among students and to recover past and future costs to the district related to vaping epidemic, citing deceptive marketing practices targeting school-age minors. The lawsuit will be filed against Juul Labs, Inc.
Okay, is there a motion
to
start legal action to combat the vaping epidemic among our students?
So moved.
Okay, second. It has been moved by Mr. Colon and seconded by Mr. Persis. Any more discussion? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those against, please say no. Sir, thank you very much. It was approved unanimously.
Thank you very much.
Have a safe trip home. Thank you. Thank you all. We are now at 8:19:01. Board members, is there any other comment or questions? Okay, thank you, Ms. Schultz. Who would like to go first? Ms. Haynes.
I normally don't ask to go first, but I'd like to tonight. In trying to be better prepared for next year and, you know, everyone know what's happening, I did speak with Dr. Fritz and asked if it would be appropriate this evening to have Mr. Penley come up and join us so that we could have a discussion that in the event we're going to review the mask policy for next school year and what it would look like, what the time frame is, because I want everyone, you know, parents, teachers, everyone, to have an opportunity to know, like, I'll be honest with you, I don't want to sit through this summer like we did last summer with, you know, making decisions right at the last minute and everything, because that's not what's best for our kids, our teachers, our families, and things like that. So, if you don't mind, Ms. Cuthbert, I'd like Mr. Penley.
Certainly, if Mr. Penley thinks it's all right.
Since we made this a policy in order to make any adjustments to it, there's a timeline we have to follow.
Thank you, Mr. Penley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Yes, the policy, if it was to be amended, would need to be advertised just as we've done with 201 here tonight. You see the procedure for that. We bring forward, based on the superintendent recommendation, to change or amend a policy that is then approved for advertising. That period is a minimum of 28 days according to the Administrative Procedures Act that we follow for policy amendments and our rulemaking procedures. Then once that's advertised, we'd bring it back at the next board meeting following the 28-day advertising period, and the board then would have an opportunity to vote that policy up or down. In this case, if we were to do something prior to July, it would mean bringing this forward at least by the 1st of May.
Okay, 1st of May. So that gives us the next board meeting?
May 4th, I believe, is okay. The May 4th or 5th. I can't recall.
April 27th
is the
next one.
Yeah, April 27th.
So the next board meeting.
Okay. So that's something we will have to discuss tomorrow at our agenda conference. Yes, Mr.
So when I sat on the Florida Board of Respiratory Care, we often opened rules. We met quarterly. So we often opened
rulemaking or said, you know, for example, we knew every year the department would have changes to the application for, and so we were able to open rules. I mean, we had a whole list that we said, okay, we're going to open these up for rulemaking. And so some time could go by, at which point then we could decide, okay, there is a change, you know, this year we're not going to ask the age in a bubble form, we're going to ask it in a write-it-in form, because that's what the department or the legislation or whatever changed. And we would then have to advertise for the 28 days, but the rule was left open so that we could, in other words, it wasn't open it, meet, wait 28 days. So arguably, I mean, does that not apply the same here? So as what I'm thinking is if we, let's say we open this up for rule making, and that would mean if we were trying to make a decision by July, then we would need to know by the 1st of June to be able to get to those 28 days, but it could stay open for that because you have to advertise after you make the change. So is that any, is that different for us? I'm just wondering.
I really couldn't speak to that. I don't know about, we do not have under the Administrative Procedure Act a way of holding rules open, if I'm understanding your question correctly.
Right, so, okay. So I'll share that with you because again, we met quarterly, so we had to basically say, we want to open these 10 rules that we know every year are there's changes. We still had to vote and advertise, so that meant it came back the next quarter, but it was left open for that. So in this case, it would be 28 days. So we would, if there was a change, we'd have to advertise it and then bring it to the next board meeting 28 days later.
I'm not sure exactly, but I can tell you it sounds like I've represented clients before that only had rulemaking twice a year. So all of your rules were, you had one workshop, if you want to call it that, and you went over all the rule changes, but then you couldn't on a every other month or as we do, as needed basis, revise any other rules. It was, that was your time for doing rulemaking policy revisions at the January and November meetings or whatever, but you weren't then allowed to bring forward any amendments to your policies in the interim. So here, at least since the 9 months I've been with you, it seems that you don't have that practice. I think it's a good one, if that's what you're asking.
Yes, Ms. Haynes.
So, Mr. Penley, my thought in this is, you know, if parents are going to choose, you know, there are parents waiting out there right now to determine if they're going to send their kids back to brick and mortar, because there are parents that chose to not send their kids back because we did put a mask policy in place. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we may have some parents that will say, I now may not want brick and mortar. I may want Volusia online learning because you're going to make it optional. You know, my personal thought is I would like to make this optional, you know, and I've said that before, where students can choose whether or not they want to wear a mask. There is no shaming either way. There's no bullying. You know, it's because right now, you know, the mask goes against our you know, dress code policy, you know. And so we've got a mask policy. We've not had everyone adhere to it this year. At times we've had children punished, which I said from day one I did not agree with children being punished, but that is still going on out there. And it's wrong. I mean, it is wrong to punish a child over a mask, I believe. You know, what we've not looked at is we've not looked at peer-reviewed data to actually see, you know, we're listening to one group of individuals, but yet we're not looking at some of the statistical data that's coming out because, quite frankly, in the United States, we've never had mask policies. Like, we've not had our, you know, children or adults masked for any periods of time. You know, yes, I've been on a flight before where maybe somebody has chosen to put a mask on that flight, but that's a choice they made. It wasn't something that was dictated. And I just would like to see, and granted I'm one person, but I'd like to see it brought back up, look at making it optional, and, you know, and no longer having penalties or, you know, punishment for students or even teachers that choose to not wear it or wear it. And I need it. I want it personally done in a time period that parents don't miss deadlines if they're wanting to make another choice, you know, because if we wait too long, then we then do like what happened this past summer, then they're like, well, you decided this now, and I can't get into VOL, or I can't go this route, or whatever. And I think when I talked to you, though, I did ask you, you know, if something were to, like, if we were to move forward on making adjustment to the language, publishing it, you know, for the 28 days, coming back and voting for it to be optional, if something were to change, like if we were to hit, you know, August, which is what happened this past year, and we were looking at the numbers, and there was some drastic change that, you know, even where the federal government or state government came down and said, we've now got to institute this, we could at that time, even if we've made it optional, we could impose an emergency order, correct?
Just as we did last summer with the 90-day emergency order, the purpose under the Florida Administrative Procedure Act is to allow you to advertise an emergency policy during that 90 days. You can't extend it beyond the 90 days, as we talked about when we implemented this policy 503 back in October on a permanent, quote-unquote, permanent basis. I know you don't like the use of the term, but we adopted the policy as a regular policy, not an emergency policy, in October for that reason. The only caveat that I would give you to think about, and I know that Mr. Colon, at the following the presentation from the health department at the last meeting, the affirmative defense to lawsuits over COVID that the legislature just passed and the governor signed back at the beginning of the month is contingent upon you following CDC guidelines. That's the only concern that I have about modifying the policy, because the CDC has not modified their guidance.
And I hear you on that, but as we learned in the workshop last week or 2 weeks ago, we've not followed all of the CDC guidelines. We didn't follow the CDC guidelines for sports, you know, which was very clear. After, you know, Ms. Boswell read what the sports guidelines were, we haven't followed those. You know, yes, it's been reduced to 3 feet right now, but, you know, from 6 feet to 3 feet, but we've been at 3 feet or less in some instances for a very long time. What bothered me last week, or when Ms. Boswell spoke, and I let it go at that moment, was when she answered Mr. Colon, she said, these could go away. She said plexiglass shields could go away. Did she not? All right. But when I said for testing, when children are sitting in an assigned seat for testing, where we spread kids out for testing to ensure, hopefully, that there is no cheating that takes place, because part of being a testing coordinator is you have to submit a seating chart for that classroom that says, that's where Jamie Haynes is sitting for this test for the 3 days she's there. That's her spot. And Jamie Haynes is behind plexiglass. And when I said to her, she's like, fine that they can have water. But the minute I said to her, so if they're sitting behind plexiglass for 3 days or 5 days taking this test, can they remove their mask? She's then like, no, you're removing a layer. Well, is this a layer? Yes. But she said, this layer we could go earlier. Then she said, this layer can't go. This is cherry picking what we want to do versus what we don't want to do. I still go back to this. I fought hard that kids would not wear these outside for PE and recess and running and everything. We still got spots where people are doing that to them, okay? We fought hard that kids could lower it to take a drink of water, and then I have a kid send me an email saying, I can't take a drink of water, Ms. Haynes, because my teacher yells at me. We've got children the children have worked hard at following the rules, especially those little ones, okay? And they've got dirty masks on their face. I said that to Ms. Boswell. How is a dirty mask healthy for children to be wearing all day? All right, so I like to see this optional. I understand if an order comes down, we may have to go back into an emergency piece and make it not optional. But, you know, we're moving forward. People have, I really feel like washing the hands and keeping the areas clean are making a bigger difference than kids touching their face. I find myself all day long when I have this thing on just spending my time touching my face, adjusting it. And I can't think that that's healthy because I used to not ever touch my face. So that's just where I stand. And I know that I'm only one of five, but I'd like to look at us. I'd like to ask the rest of you to consider making this optional, advertising it, choosing to vote for it or against it, and with the thought that if something changes when it's time for school to start, we put forth an emergency order, which is what we did this past year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Ms. Burnett.
I don't have anything to say. Thanks.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Nothing to say. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else have any comments about this?
I would suggest that we look into it again. I just think if we can somehow advertise it superly so folks understand, because the thought that we'll make a decision in 2 weeks for something that's going to be 3 months from now, 4 months from now, I can't count how many months from now it is.
At least three.
You know, that's hard. And I will say it does feel like we are heading in the right direction. As far as, you know, the vaccinations and all that's taken place, I don't know that in 2 weeks we will be there. And so I just think if we explore that, you know, I don't know right now how much I am in favor of going ahead and amending a policy and then going the emergency route, versus if we could leave the policy open, we would still have to advertise. And so that then would cut down on a little bit of the time. It would be a month away from the decision rather than 4 months away. What are we, in April?
It's still April.
August, so 4 months.
Mr. Colon, I'm looking at if we brought it back up from the next board meeting, which is April 27th, because I took a calendar out and went through it with Mr. Penley, we would make the changes to the language on the 27th. Then it would still have to go out to be... We would have to agree on the changes of the language, and we may not, and so it would come back up then to the next meeting, then go out 28 days. So we would be voting on it towards the end of June to institute it for next year. Because if you remember, we only have one board meeting scheduled in July, unlike last year where we had six, you know, because we had to keep doing it. We typically only meet once in July. Well, if we wait till the end of July to make a vote on this, enrollment for other programs at that time will be closed. And so we will have shut a door, not really letting parents know where we stand on what we're going to do or not do. And so I walked through the calendar with him to figure out, you know, where we were time-wise, because we wait, then, you know, it's 28 days. And so we'd be talking about this the last week of July with school getting ready to start the middle of August, and we won't make it in time. And I don't want I want parents to know. I want teachers to know, and I want students to know. I don't want to be where we were last year, you know, making decisions at the last moment and it impacting people and everybody being upset. I'm a planner and an organizer, and I think we need to get the information out there.
What I'm afraid of is what the decision I may make in 2 weeks may not be the one that I make in August, or in July, or even in June. And I think, you know, that's kind of where Ruben is on it, because we are, that's a long time away in COVID time. And at that point, we would be choosing to steer away from the guidance. And that,
if you think about it, we're breaking what the governor already put out. I mean, in one sense, he says you can't fine anybody or penalize them for not wearing it. And then, yes, I know what came out in the other piece. And, like, there's all this contradiction.
There's lots.
And you know what? I'd be a whole lot better if people had followed the policy the way we even put the policy out. But the policy's not been followed this year. And we, like I said, we've cherry-picked which rules we follow from the CDC.
Okay. Thank you for all your views. Do you have anything, your view? Do you have a view? You're a healthcare worker as well.
Well, I mean, I can understand both sides of all of this. And I do think that we owe it to our students and the teachers and the parents to have a plan in place in enough time to where they can make a decision based on what they want to do and where they believe, where their beliefs are, and where they want to manage their health. Mm-hmm. And is there something that we can do that if a mandate does come down that says you must wear a mask from whomever, the governor, the president, whomever, isn't that something that can be built into this policy that we would like to amend anyway? I do think that we have to plan in advance for this, and I think we've all seen this coming. But I do think we need to plan for that.
Okay. Would you like to add anything about Ms. Haynes' suggestion?
Well, you know, I was thinking that you were thinking April 27th
to work on
some
changing
kind of a workshop, because it's going to take a little time to flesh out mm-hmm. the right language, even though I know you'll do a great job, but giving us as many options so we can make it as flexible mm-hmm. as we can, and I know that's kind of hard to do, but I was thinking you would want to do it maybe that first meeting, Madam Chair, in May. That's normally our workshop day, you know, that first Tuesday.
I think it's the 11th. I think, isn't the 11th the first Tuesday in May?
You know, one of those 10 a.m. workshop days. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I was thinking along that line, and my thinking was that, of course, I wanted to get something optional in place by the July summer school, which starts July 6th or 5th or something like that.
I have dates.
At the very least, that may show us, hey, did this work or did it not? And how many kids wore a mask and how many didn't? And what kind of feedback did we get from that? I mean, I don't know, but I'd like the policy to be so that if we decided that we didn't want to do that, that we could go back, you know, and make it a mandatory or make it optional. I hate that we have to do this 28-day thing all the time and then plan a month almost before the 28 days.
Our last meeting in June is June 22nd, and that was, I mean, like I said, I took a calendar and worked my way back to try to figure out, you know, when we could do this.
Yeah, so if we advertised it that whole month of May, or the middle of May to the middle of June, that would still give you that one school board meeting at the end of June to vote on.
Okay, Dr. Fritz, would you like to weigh in?
This is, you know, I'm respecting our roles. This is a board policy. I certainly have an opinion, but I would like to see. This is almost like with the graduation ticket. You got to kind of see where we're going, but at the same point in time, I'd like us to start working towards a voluntary program. I think that's what our families want. But I agree with you that I don't want to have six board meetings in mm-hmm. July. I think we have to look at the timeline. I think the more information we could put out with the caveat that if we have to come back and change it, we can. I think parents would appreciate doing it earlier rather than later. But that's just my two cents. But, again, truly this is a board decision to decide whether or not we would go forward. Mr. Penley and I will take the information if you decide to go in that direction and you want us to bring it back on the 27th. We'll start the ball rolling. If you want to wait till that first board meeting in May, recognizing that the final approval with that would be the June, probably the second board meeting in June, that's fine. If you wait past that second board meeting in May, though, to make a decision, you're talking about holding a special board meeting are only giving parents 2 weeks to make a decision, and they're going to have to make some educational decisions based on where we go.
That's not fair to them.
So I would suggest that we either try, if the board has a pleasure to move in this direction, that we either do it at 27th or the first board meeting in May at the latest.
Okay. Mr. Penley, do you agree?
Well, I was just looking at the dates. We're looking at May 11th as being the workshop date and the 25th. Then if May, we could bring it back for discussion informally on the 27th at the next meeting to kind of give you an idea. It's very difficult to write a rule or a policy that's flexible by nature, okay? That's my challenge. I will accept it. Thank you for that, Mr. Persis. I will do my best. We could then bring it back in final version with a request for authorization to advertise on the 11th. That would put us with publication deadlines around the 13th or 14th, getting that out to the papers, 1, 2, 3, 4. That would be right then for discussion and for revision approval. Final approval, that would be after the 11th of June. And I'm not sure, I believe the meeting date for that for June is the...
It's June 22nd.
22nd.
And that's the last one for this fiscal year, for this school year. And then we don't meet again until July 27th, which is too late.
Yep. Okay. Everything needs to be in place at latest by that last board meeting in June, if not before.
I only have one concern. Looking back, you know, now that we have this opportunity to look back this past year, first of all, it was my age group and older that were very much at risk and affected. A lot of the vaccines started with my age group and older. And recently, very recently, the 20 to 40-year-olds are becoming ill more severely, and the cases are going up. And also, even though the cases in Florida may go down, but we're, number one in the country, or part of number one in the country for the variants. So I think that might help you in maybe putting a data point in the policy that if the cases become more dangerous to younger people, because they're talking about children and 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds. We have a lot of faculty members and volunteers and admin who are in those age groups. Our teenagers, even our ESE, some are with us until 22, 24 years old. They're all affected. So that might help us. If that becomes worse, then that would be a way for us to remove ourselves from this. But I worry about our children, yeah. And because we cannot control what they do at home. We can't control what they do in spring break or Christmas break or over Labor Day. And because of that, I think a lot of the smaller districts have been successful because there's more of a family camaraderie. There's more of a community message. And even our smaller private schools have been able to keep their numbers down because everyone agrees in order to go to that school, they agree to behave in a certain manner so their children are healthy. We don't have that. We don't have that luxury because we accept every student who walks in our front door. So I think that may help us make those decisions. And my concern is summer school. You know, we're in July, and when students are going to be going for the remedial programs in June and July, what will they be experiencing? They're going to go out for recess, and how crowded will they be in those rooms? And I know we have some really good pilot programs starting July 1, but I do know a lot of my schools in my district are having a lot of difficulties with cleanliness these days with ABM. And there's a lot of staff problems going on. So I think all of it together, I think we'll discuss it at our agenda conference tomorrow. So I would rather look at it sooner than later so we can meet what our parents are discussing. I'd like to hear from the parents. I'd like to hear from our faculty and our admin because they're the ones that have to uphold it. But also we have to make sure our schools are clean and sanitized and ready to go. We have to have that deep cleaning this summer So everybody has to buy in, and everybody has to, maybe we can, you know, in order to do this, we have to make other, I can't say demands, but other strong suggestions of cleanliness in order to help this occur. So.
That's helpful. If I understand the board's pleasure, based on consensus, it's that the superintendent brings forward on the April 27th meeting a recommendation for amendments to policy 503, and we will try to build in some threshold levels and flexibility to the maximum extent that we can to address the board's concern, and then we can make modifications at that meeting and bring forward for advertising those changes after the board has an opportunity to review the draft policies.
Okay.
Is that sum it up?
Thank you.
I think you did a good job, sir.
All right.
Okay, I think you have a consensus.
Okay, well,
thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I say one thing?
I
just saw this pop up.
Okay.
Where is Beatrice? Is that in Illinois? Iowa?
Beatrice.
After several months of mandating masks in Beatrice Public Schools, the school board voted to make mask wearing optional for students and staff for the remainder of the school year. The action included the stipulation that the board can reinstate the mandate if there is a considerable risk because of increased positivity rates or sudden spikes in school cases.
Mm-hmm.
So, just
we can do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that has to do with a lot of the, especially the variants.
I think we're up to right now 26 districts in Florida at the last count have this as optional. So
for next year, right, or this year?
Some made it optional from the start this year, like they never instituted a policy, but some have now backed off and made it optional, like to finish out the year or for already made the move for next year. And I've talked to a few board members in some of the other districts that made it mandatory like we did, and they're in the same place as looking at it being, you know, optional for next year. And so, you know, I want to be very clear. I said last June optional. I'm still saying optional. I'm not saying we say no mask, okay? I'm just saying allow staff, parents, and students to make that decision for themselves. You know, and Mr. Persis, I like what you just, you know, read, because we could, I mean, Mr. Penley, I don't even know if we could even put, like, if we have a hot spot of a school, you know, that, you know, I'm going to use Pine Ridge for a moment. Like, if we have a breakout on Pine Ridge and, you know, we've got, you know, 150 kids out or something, then, you know, what's our steps that we're going to do? We're going to go in and clean Pine Ridge and maybe have to say, all right, they've got to do something. But, I mean, I think I just want options.
Okay.
Nebraska. Because I know you all want
Nebraska,
to
yes. Beatrice, this is what I feel good
with. Beatrice,
we have,
Nebraska.
We have the ninja of school board attorneys. I can't wait to see his writing on this. I think it's going to be great. but he's got his marching orders to go forward, and we will bring it back to the 27th for review with the board.
Okay. Thank you. All right, that was a very nice board member comment. So thank you. We needed the discussion. Mr. Penley, I thank you very much for assisting us in Ms. Haynes' endeavor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Burnett, you have any member comments?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Mr. Persis, do you have anything else to not say?
No, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Ma'am.
Mr. Cologne, how about you, darling?
Is this a bad time to say we should revisit uniforms?
Let's not do that tonight. Thank
Sounds
you.
Good. I have
Even
nothing.
I, who have always made that a hot topic, let's not do that tonight. But I greatly appreciate you. Thank you so much. We can talk about that in May. May's a good time. May's
May.
A good time. When we know we're almost out of school. Okay, the only thing I would like to say is we just recently had Future celebrate the first-year teacher. I'd also like to celebrate all of you in the audience tonight who are our first-year administrators. Would you stand if you've just finished 1 year or just short of 1 year or maybe a year and a half you've been with us?
That's that whole team over
there.
That's the
whole crew over here. And Dr. Fritz, you need a minute.
Whole cabinet.
Yeah. All right. All right, congratulations. Thank you very much for your dedication to Volusia County Schools. The oldie but goodies in the audience.
All right. We're still here.
All right. and I think it's a good mixture. We learn from you, and you learn from us. So with that said, if there's – oh, wait a minute. You have anything else to say? Okay, anything else to say, sir? All right, with that, we adjourn, and it's only 6:40. All right, baby doll.